You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio this week Ann Wright. She has been on before. She is a retired Army colonel and State Department official. She has the State Department Award for Heroism. She publicly resigned in 2003 in protest of the war on Iraq. She has been part of all sorts of efforts for peace and justice, from Camp Casey to Gaza flotillas, and she is just back from another attempt to reach the people of Gaza. She was on the Women's Boat to Gaza. You can check out womensboattogaza.us or wbg.freedomflotilla.org. Ann Wright, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David. It's great to talk to you, and it's great to be back from the flotilla.
Yes, I was receiving rather disturbing emails with headlines like, Ann Wright has been kidnapped, and I was rather grateful to hear that you were released and then that you were leaving Israel and were back in New York. What was the Women's Boat to Gaza? What is the Women's Boat to Gaza, and what did you try to do?
Well, it is an initiative of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla International Coalition that we've had since 2010, and this is the fourth flotilla that we have sailed to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza, the illegal quarantine and blockade of the little tiny place called Gaza, 25 miles wide or 25 miles long, 5 miles wide. 1.9 million people living in that tiny little space that is essentially an open-air prison controlled by the Israelis.
So you took a boat. Did you bring aid, or did you just try to bring people? And what happened when you tried to get there?
Well, this time we just were bringing ourselves and our message of hope that the people, that indeed the international community has not forgotten the people of Gaza, although to the people of Gaza it certainly feels like the international world, the world community has kind of left them. So this tiny little boat, and it was supposed to be two boats, but you know how boats happen sometimes. Not all the boats go at the time that you want, or sometimes these little boats break. We had two sailboats, one called the Amal, which in Arabic means hope, and the second one was Zaytuna Olivia, for the olives that are the part of Palestinian culture and really Arabic culture that are so important to them, and whose roots, olive tree roots, are deep in the soil of Gaza and the West Bank, and many of the trees being hundreds, if not maybe even thousands of years old. So they're part of the great history. So we named one of our boats the Zaytuna Olivia and the other one Amal Hope. We started out from Barcelona, Spain. That's where we purchased both of these boats. They are sailboats, 50 feet long, and having a capacity, well, we put 13 women on each boat, although it was really jam-packed with people with that many. We only had four staterooms in each one of the boats, and so it meant that we were having to put three people to a stateroom, and people would have to rotate around during the evening hours to sleep. But it was part of the challenge of difficult living, which is nothing in comparison to what the people of Gaza feel on their on a daily basis, when their entire life is controlled by the Israeli government in terms of supplies that come in, merchandise that comes into Gaza is all controlled by the Israelis, as is the electricity that comes in or doesn't come in, which is most of the time. Most people in Gaza only have like 4 hours of electricity a day, and the water controlled by Israel, and then the sewage plants, which are generally the first targets of an Israeli attack. So, our little boats were going across 1,715 miles of the Mediterranean from Spain through Corsica down to Messina, Italy, and then a 1,000-mile journey across from Sicily to Gaza.
And you're sailing east toward Gaza, and on previous trips, a previous flotilla, the Israeli military stopped and killed and wounded people. I mean, this is what you were sailing toward, right?
Well, that's right. In 2010, I was a part of that Freedom Flotilla, six ships that sailed toward Gaza, having left Cyprus and Crete, and were attacked by the Israeli occupation forces, and nine activists were killed, really executed by the Israeli forces. A tenth person subsequently died. Over 50 people were wounded by the Israelis as they came aboard by rappelling down from helicopters, by climbing up from Zodiacs that were streaming alongside the Mavi Marmara, where the fatal attacks took place. But each one of the ships was boarded forcefully, and people beaten up, tasered, faces shoved in glass that had been blown out by stun guns. Each boat was attacked, and people injured by the Israelis on each one of those. And so, yes, we knew that there was a potential for violence. There have been other flotillas that have gone where people have been beaten up and constrained with handcuffs and put in stress positions for long periods of time until the boats actually were brought in against our will. You know, we really consider it being kidnapped on the high seas in international waters. Our boat was taken 35 miles off Gaza in international waters, and 14 miles from what the Israelis have declared as their security zone around Gaza. So we were clearly in international waters. We were boarded by a military force. Our control of our boat was taken over by the military, and we were forced to go to Israel against our will. And then, as what happens each time, then we are charged with entering Israel illegally, even though we didn't want to go there in the first place, and we're taken there against our will, and then subsequently deported. And again, it's a 10-year deportation from Israel, which means that essentially that you can't get into the West Bank again to be in solidarity with Palestinians in the West Bank, because you've now been excluded, deported from Israel.
Yeah. 200 years ago, my neighbor here in Charlottesville, Thomas Jefferson, started a big war in the Mediterranean because ships were being boarded and kidnapped like that, although it was Muslims doing it. So it was a different rhetoric and, I suppose, different sort of evil. But this is a crime that Israel committed, right? Is there any sort of ability to prosecute it as a crime?
Well, indeed, it is a crime, and it is difficult to get prosecutions going. It has been difficult even for the executions of the nine people and subsequently the 10th death of those that were killed 6 years ago. I myself have testified twice in a court in Istanbul, Turkey, where we were trying to mount a court case against the four Israeli general officers in the Navy and in the land forces for their participation and planning in this military assault that resulted in the murders of 10 unarmed civilians on the Mavi Marmara. The case is still in the courts, although the Israeli government has kind of bought off the Turkish government by offering a $20 million payment to be split among the families of those who were killed, although the families have said they don't want the money. They want justice for their loved ones' deaths. But the Erdogan government of Turkey, wanting better relations with Israel, I guess, for economic reasons, has now reestablished diplomatic relations with Israel And the government has accepted this money for the families, even though the families say they don't want it. In fact, the widow of one of the men that was murdered on the Mavi Marmara was one of our delegates who came to Messina, Italy. And I had not seen her since the last time I was in Istanbul for the court case. And it was a moving time to be there with her, and you know, her willingness to go on another boat that would be confronting the Israeli military. Ultimately, she was not on the one boat that finally did go toward Gaza, but her heart was certainly with us, and we really appreciated her willingness to come to Sicily and to meet with all the other participants from 18 other countries that had come to Messina as a part of this women's boat to Gaza.
We're speaking with Anne Wright, who was on the women's boat to Gaza. Check out womensboattogaza.us. Anne, I noticed that it's called the women's boat. It had only women. The two boats had only women, or three boats, and women from the West and from around the world, and well-known women. And I noticed also that the Israeli public relations stressed to all the media that there were women involved in capturing and kidnapping everybody on the boat. So what is the strategy here, and what do you think the Israeli military would have done differently had there been men on board?
Well, we know what they do normally when men are on board, because this has been four times they've done it. Usually there's a much stronger confrontation, and indeed, in virtually every one of the other flotillas, people have been tasered, and people have been kind of thrown around on the decks, and none of them shot as such, but they have been tasered. It was a different approach we were taking as women, led by a Nobel Peace Laureate, Mairead McGuire from Northern Ireland, and with two parliamentarians, one from the Algeria Parliament and one from the New Zealand Parliament. We had an Olympic athlete and a student activist from South Africa. We had a second, what they call a substitute member of parliament from Sweden. We had a group of women who are truly committed to peaceful, nonviolent resistance. And our idea was that we were not going to be confrontational in a way that resulted in injuries to anyone. I mean, there were two of us that were over 70 years old. I just turned 70 this year, and Mairead McGuire is over 70, and several of the others were in their 60s. And, you know, in the whole approach to what we want to do, we wanted to be an example of how you can push a political agenda, but you don't have to be physically confrontational about it, and that maybe this change in kind of an approach toward those who are going to be coming on board our boat, we wanted to see what would happen. And indeed, we'd kind of publicized that, how we'd gone through nonviolence training and, you know, that confrontation was not the way we wanted to go about things. So, as it turned out, the Israeli military was listening, and when they approached in their Zodiac boats, three of them, each loaded to the gills. I mean, they had a lot of people on these things. And the first one that came up to stop our boat, the half of the people that were on that were women members of the Israeli occupation forces. And interestingly, they were not dressed in combat gear. When they came up, I about fell out of the boat because I was thinking we were going to see all sorts of weapons and helmets and flak jackets and all that, which is normally what we see. But they had changed their tactics too, and they approached us wearing baseball caps, wearing long sleeve jerseys with a blue military vest. I'm pretty sure it was a bulletproof vest, but a lightweight one. And each one of them had a GoPro on, so they were recording everything. And when they boarded the boat, it was not rush onto the boat and making everybody sit right where they were, although there was no place for us to move anyway. We pretty well had to stay seated because it was so crowded in the little cockpit. And we wanted all of our delegates, all 13 people, to be visible and on the deck. I wanted all of those 13 women to be able to go back to their countries to tell exactly what happened and to be able to see first in the distance three large warships that were trailing us. And then at a certain point, we saw these three Zodiac fast boats coming up from the rear, and then as they approached us, and on the radio, they were calling to us, Zaytuna, Zaytuna, stop, heading for Gaza. Our captain, Madeline Habib, who is an Australian citizen, her father was Egyptian, or is Egyptian, and her mother is from the UK, and she grew up in Australia. Captain Madeline Habib is one of the most experienced women captains I suspect there is in the world. And we were very, very lucky that she decided she wanted to volunteer to be a captain on this mission. As she was talking to the captain of one of the ships that was calling the Zaytuna, and her description of what we were doing, that we were not going to stop, we were heading for Gaza, that it was our right to, and that it was an illegal Israeli blockade, and that we were going to continue to go to Gaza because our mission was to give hope to the people of Gaza that they were not forgotten, and we intended to do that. And then the Israeli commander of one of the ships, in what was a pretty professional exchange, said, "I understand what your mission is, but I must say that we have an approved a security area," which I don't think that's true, but we have an approved security area that you cannot enter, and we ask you to divert to the Israeli port of Ashdod. And our captain said, "Nope, we're not going to divert. It is our right to go to the people of Gaza to give them hope." So with that, the fast boats approached, and the 15 people hopped onto our boat really fast, and including a young woman who became, she took over the control of our boat. She as we found out later, as we talked with her, she is is licensed for sailing boats of that size, and so she took over control of our boat, and then diverted our boat toward the Israeli port of Ashdod.
Yeah. Were you guys set up to live stream video? I know that from last time that the Israeli military very much wanted to, you know, destroy any footage or photos not produced by themselves. What was your approach in terms of creating media of this non-confrontational confrontation?
Yeah, well, we did have two Al Jazeera women journalists on board, complete with the professional Al Jazeera camera and a satellite link, and they were transmitting to a certain point until the Israeli military was able to cut off communications with the satellite. So they were unable to get actually footage of when the IDF actually boarded the boat. And the hours later, it took us over 8 hours from when they boarded our vessel until we finally reached the port of Ashdod, because our sailboat could only go like we could go faster than 5 knots, but it was really putting a lot of strain on the engine to do it. And so it took us 8 hours to get into Ashdod. I'm surprised that the IDF itself has not put out some of the photos of themselves, because it is a different approach that they took toward our boat, and it was an accurate assessment of who we were and what our mission was. And in fact, several of the young sailors mentioned to us, they said, "Well, you know, we as sailors, we understand how difficult this voyage has been for you all, because we were on the high seas on that leg of it, 8 or 9 days, and from Barcelona to Ajaccio, Sicily, was 3 days, including two very, very rough days where everybody on board the boat was seasick. And then from Ajaccio, Corsica, down to Messina, Italy, that was another 3.5 days. And then from Messina to Gaza, that was a 9-day trip. So 1,715 miles we traveled in this little boat with the population on the boat, including the crew, of 13 women. So the young sailor said, we know how difficult these trips can be, and we admire you for the trip you've made, not necessarily for the reason you were making it, but that from a sailing point of view, it was really interesting that they said that they were impressed with what our women's boat to Gaza had done.
They were impressed and admired you, and then they locked you up.
And then locked us up.
Right. What, to tell us that bit quickly. What did they do?
Well, yes, as at the end of all of these sagas, although I'll just mention one thing. As we were heading into the port of Ashdod, we were approaching the coastline, and, you know, the coast of Gaza goes right into the coast of Israel, and we actually came right at the city of Ashkelon, which is the southernmost Israeli city next to Gaza, and the incredible difference between Israel to the left of Ashkelon, with the great bright lights of coastal cities and, you know, an industrialized nation of 8.1 million people, and then you look to the south and the 25-mile coastline to the south, which is Gaza, in virtually complete darkness, and 1.9 million people, nearly a quarter of the population of Israel, is living in perpetual darkness because of the Israeli policies. Not only the darkness of the lights, but the darkness of not having medical supplies. One of the people we had on board our ship was a medical doctor from Malaysia, Dr. Fasia Hassan. Her NGO that works in Gaza is trying to reduce the time that people have to wait for operations. Right now, the number of people that have applied for various kind or have been recommended for various kind of operations and the current medical facilities they have in Gaza, it means that many of these people will not see an operation until the year 2025, 9 years from now. And her organization is trying to bring in enough supplies and equipment that they can bring down this time to the year 2020, 4 years of a wait. So this type of information that we were getting about the collapse of the medical facilities because of the intentional bombing of hospitals and the reduction of the amount of medical supplies that are allowed in by the State of Israel, and then the continual darkness because of lack of electricity, so students can't study as much, and the darkness of not being able to travel, that indeed you are stuck in that little place with little opportunity to take advantage of scholarships to get out or to go visit family any place in the world. So it was really a stark thing, approaching the coast of Gaza and seeing it in darkness, and then being taken to the port of Ashdod, and in the same processing that we did 6 years ago, last time I was in there, we were processed. It took about 2.5 hours for 13 people to be processed. 6 years ago, we had over 700 people to be processed. Then we were taken to a detention facility near Gibeon, where we stayed for 24 hours before ultimately we went before an administrative detention judge and were deported. And the following night, most of us left in a 12-hour period. All of us are now back in our homes and doing interviews to continue to educate people about what is going on and to focus international attention on the people of Gaza and the horrific conditions in which they're living.
Ann Wright, we have about 3.5 minutes left. The policy of the U.S. government is to give ever more billions of dollars of free weapons to Israel without any demands and excuse all of its crimes and abuses. And we have this media circus around a presidential election in which, if you don't pay any attention to Jill Stein, you have two candidates who never bring up the topic, who both endorse the cruelty, but one is presented as a respecter of diversity and human rights, and the other as a cruel jerk. What do you make of the of U.S. politics, and what should we be doing to help the people of Gaza?
Well, certainly we should not have given this $38 billion gift over the next 10 years to the state of Israel, where they will be using that money to kill Palestinians, to again attack people in Gaza kind of an experimental way. I mean, Gaza is the test bed for not only Israeli weapons but U.S. weapons. And this $38 billion is going to be used in great measure to purchase more weapons to kill Palestinians, if not in Gaza, in the West Bank. And we should be ashamed as a country that we continue to finance Israel in this manner. And it's really shocking in that President Obama, who has been vilified by Prime Minister Netanyahu, that he didn't, on just a personal basis, veto that congressional giveaway program. But he didn't, and the world looks in great disbelief, not only at our political system, which is a circus, but at this the continual support for the state of Israel, no matter what criminal acts it conducts toward people of Gaza and the West Bank, and toward the international community, which is the part of it which is critical about the policies of the state of Israel.
But no matter what sort of memo a president writes, Congress can't actually pass 10 years of funding in 1 year, right? It has to come back 9 more times and redo that or undo it. And major changes are promised on other topics by people running for president now. We ought to be able to make a change on this one during one of the coming 9 years, right?
We certainly will give it a try, but Israeli policies and politics and U.S. politics are so intertwined that it will continue to be a very, very difficult problem. However, you can see the success that the boycott, divestment, and sanction programs have had, where 2 years ago Netanyahu said that BDS is a strategic threat to the state, to the security of the state of Israel. So it's worth giving lots of push on these things, because every now and then you have some breakthroughs that really make a difference.
So join in Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. Search. There are good websites on it. Go also to womensboattogaza.us and wbg.freedomflotilla.org. Support this effort. I assume it is not finished. Ann Wright, thank you once again for everything you're doing for peace, and thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
A real pleasure, David, and thanks for all the work that you're doing.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you might believe there's a general liberalization afoot in this country with regard to drug use. But the reality is that every state and the federal government criminalizes the possession of illicit drugs for personal use. The discriminatory and devastating way those laws are enforced is the subject of a sweeping new report called Every 25 Seconds, The Human Toll of Criminalizing Drug Use in the United States. We'll talk with lead author Tess Borden, REA Nyer Fellow at Human Rights Watch and the American Civil Liberties Union. Also on the show, it's difficult to imagine a story that brings together more of the most urgent issues of the moment than the standoff over the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's not a harbinger of the fight to make keep it in the ground more than a slogan. Harbingers are about the future and climate disruption, and the overwhelmingly powerless people on its front lines are stories about today. So who's telling that story? We'll hear about that from Mark Trahant, journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. Blaming millennials would appear to be hot for 2016. FAIR analyst Adam Johnson notes the cohort has so far been blamed for killing everything from the movie business to napkins. In the context of the 2016 election, Johnson says, talking about millennials, an arbitrary marketing distinction, is mostly a way for writers to create tension in a piece of political commentary without the messy enterprise of dissecting sexism, white supremacy, or class conflict. It's a safe way to generate traffic, too vague to be offensive, specific enough to appear meaningful. One version is the effort by some pundits to blame millennials for the rise of Donald Trump, sometimes by pointing the finger at falling standards of civic education. The Daily Beast's Saul Stern cites a book called The Dumbest Generation to claim that kids today disdain intellectual curiosity and the culture of books. Max Boot at Foreign Policy takes that and adds a Sanders-bashing spin, saying the most obvious consequence of young people's dismaying lack of knowledge is, quote, the extent to which Trump and Bernie Sanders, the fascist and the socialist, have transfixed the electorate this year, in spite of their complete absence of workable policy proposals, close quote. The problem should be clear enough. If Trump's support were tethered to declining education standards, the younger someone is, the more recently they were educated, the more likely they would be to vote Trump. But Trump's voters actually trend older. He's most popular with voters 65 and up, least popular with those under 30. So how can those pesky kids be blamed for Trump when so few support him? And how can Sanders and Trump, whose supporters are generational opposites, be part of the same downward trend? Besides blaming youth for something for which their own age groups are much more responsible and sidestepping racism, sexism, and xenophobia as draws for Trump, this elite line that blames schools for dumbing kids down lets the corporate media, with their decades of far-right normalizing in general and their propping up of Trump's brand in particular, completely off the hook. In the three presidential and vice presidential debates we've seen so far, Russia or Putin were mentioned 137 times. ISIS and terrorism came up 101 times. Taxes, whether tax policy or Trump's tax returns, were talked about 171 times. Climate change, on the other hand, was mentioned only 3 times during the debates, each time brought up in passing by Hillary Clinton, despite being widely recognized as the biggest existential threat facing humanity. Moderators didn't ask a single question about it, nor were there any questions about the environment, China, gun control or gun rights, education, student debt, poverty, drug policy, abortion, privacy and surveillance, Native Americans, LGBTQ issues, or campaign finance reform. Don't hold out too much hope for the final debate held on October 19th. Moderator Chris Wallace of Fox News has already announced the topics he plans to cover: debt and entitlements, immigration, the economy, the Supreme Court, foreign hotspots, and the candidate's fitness to be president. Finally, some have wondered why questions of discriminatory policing have not played a bigger role in election coverage. The second presidential debate took place some 15 miles from Ferguson, Missouri, without that name coming up. There was an opening recently when Donald Trump stated to CNN that five teenagers exonerated for the 1989 rape and assault of a woman jogging in Central Park were actually guilty. "They admitted they were guilty," Trump said. "The police doing the original investigation say they were guilty." Well, that was a great chance to talk about coerced confessions. The so-called Central Park Five were lied to, threatened, and interrogated without lawyers or their parents. Or about wrongful conviction. They all served years behind bars before DNA evidence and a confession tied another man to the crime. But only a few, like Eugene Robinson at The Washington Post and Stephen Holmes at CNN, reminded audiences of Trump's full-page screed in The New York Times, calling uncryptically for the young men to be executed and demanding an end to our continuous pandering to the criminal population. Trump's CNN statement indicates that he would still support executing people who the courts have found innocent. But no one withdrew their support or demanded an apology, and the comments were pushed off the page just hours later by the unearthing of tape of Trump joking about sexual assault. Well, those abhorrent remarks deserve the attention. But as The Intercept's Liliana Segura noted, his comments on the Central Park Five also have wider repercussion. The ugly truth, she writes, is that Trump's attitude is all too common in district attorney's offices. Prosecutors routinely defend the convictions of innocent people even after exoneration and often block efforts to test for such evidence as DNA in the first place. When convictions are overturned, DAs often refuse to drop charges, dragging out the legal fight and forcing people found innocent to live under constant threat of re-imprisonment. Governors play a role. Mike Pence recently refused to grant a pardon to a man in Indiana, exonerated with DNA evidence after 10 years in prison. Hillary Clinton has shown more concern about wrongful convictions, but Segura notes she does still support the death penalty. And while in theory one might support executions while opposing killing innocent people, reality, preeminently the exoneration of more than 150 death row prisoners to date, shows these positions are actually irreconcilable. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Police arrest more people for marijuana use than for all violent crimes combined, is the headline in The Washington Post. In The New York Times, it's marijuana arrests outnumber those for violent crimes, study finds. It's a blockbuster datum, all right, but one hopes people will read past those headlines because there's a lot more in the new report. Every 25 seconds, the human toll of criminalizing drug use in the United States. The study from Human Rights Watch and the ACLU is a multi-level, cradle-to-grave, if you will, look at the myriad impacts of the criminalization, selective criminalization, of drug possession on the people caught up in the system. We're joined now in studio by the report's lead author. Tess Borden is the R.E.A. Nyer Fellow at Human Rights Watch and the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome to Counterspin, Tess Borden.
Thank you. Great to be here, Janine.
Well, it is, as I say, a rich report. Give us a sense of the overall focus and intent. What's being pulled together here and toward what end?
So this is the result of a year-long investigation by Human Rights Watch and the ACLU into how failed and very ultimately flawed the law enforcement approach to personal drug use is. And we wanted to bring to the public's attention and to policymakers' attention the magnitude of criminalization, but also the human impact. And so I interviewed some, in fact, more than 360 people. 150 of those were prosecuted for their own drug use or possession of drugs for personal use. 64 of them were in custody when I met them. I also spoke to mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, uncles, children, adult children of those incarcerated, as well as prosecutors and police and judges and service providers. And so I think really there are some 60 stories in the report, and I really urge people to get to know those folks who are described in the report and whose stories and lives have been really shaped by the drug laws.
Well, I wonder if you could give us just, you know, an example, because media seem to have pulled out what the star datum is, you know, and there's always a tension of methodology. Journalists tell you you have to tell a story, but then if you only tell stories, you're being anecdotal and you need data. So the report does both. But I wonder if you could just give a sense of a human impact of the sort that you're collecting here.
Of course. And you're right to highlight that, you know, every 25 seconds someone is arrested for possessing drugs for their personal use. And that's a human being every 25 seconds. So one of those people was someone I call Nicole in the report. Nicole was a mother of three young children. She was in school pursuing a business administration degree in the Houston area. When I met her, she was in the Harris County Jail, an infamous jail, charged with crack cocaine residue inside a straw and heroin residue in an empty baggie. She was there ultimately for several months. She was separated from her youngest daughter as well as the other two children. The youngest was still nursing when she went inside. Her breasts were full, she told me, and that she actually had to pump herself in the shower. And she was unable to be the mother she wanted to be. The daughter came to visit her. There's glass between them. And so the little baby couldn't hear her mother's voice. She learned to sit up on her own when her mother was inside. Nicole eventually pled guilty. It was her first felony conviction. She pled guilty to 0.01 grams of heroin. Her first felony could have been charged as misdemeanor drug paraphernalia instead. And it meant she would do 7 months in prison and then she would get to go home to her children. But she said it meant literally beyond even the punishment of prison. She said, my life is over. I will be punished for the rest of my life. Because with that felony conviction, it meant Nicole was going to have to drop out of school. She could no longer qualify for the financial aid that she was getting. It meant she would no longer be able to have her name on the lease of a home she rented because people don't want to rent to quote unquote felons. It meant she would no longer qualify in the state of Texas for food stamps that she had relied on to feed her children and during her pregnancies. And so what we're seeing is just these never-ending consequences of arresting and prosecuting someone every 25 seconds. And it's not just about mass incarceration. Of course, time behind bars for any crime can have consequences that are devastating to families. But it's the disproportionality of that heavy-handed enforcement. And then it's sometimes the lifelong consequences for individuals and families of what prosecution means.
Well, and what you're so often we talk just about the law, first of all, when enforcement is key. And that's one distinction that you've just brought up. And then there's the irreducibility of racism also, which comes up in the report. It isn't that everything dissolves into that, but it does come up again and again as an important factor, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So as a matter of human rights, as the right to privacy protects what I do to my body, we find it highly problematic and even human rights violative to arrest and incarcerate someone for what they do themselves, a private action, right? And so even if there weren't racial discrimination implications, this would still be problematic. But as it plays out, it's even more alarming. And so, yes, the data shows that although black and white people use drugs at the same rates, a black person around the country is 2.5 times more likely to be arrested for simple drug possession than a white person. In many states, that number is significantly higher. In Manhattan, where we are now, it's 11 to 1. A black person is 11 times more likely to be arrested. And so how do those numbers play out? I mean, what it tells us is police have a lot of discretion about how they use their resources and where they police. And they're policing in such a way that this is who's getting picked up because it's not who's using drugs disproportionately. And I think, you know, as a country, we're looking at racial injustice. We're looking at policing. We're talking about these issues. We have to talk about drug possession laws and enforcement. The number one arrest offense, we've got to talk about that if we're talking about race and policing.
Well, I want to bring you back to actually the first part of that because, you know, of course it's important when we can show that a policy doesn't achieve its stated goal, reducing drug use, for example. But sometimes one gets the idea that if we could show, you know, an X percent reduction in Y factor, then somehow the damage that's done to people's lives would be canceled out, you know, would be overridden. And what I really appreciate about this report is the way, first of all, that it centers human beings, but that it also says that the harms done to these people, it's of itself a wrong. And I wonder, is that part of what's meant by a human rights case for decriminalization?
Absolutely, Janine, absolutely. So the right to privacy is a basic human right. The principle of autonomy undergirds many human rights. And if you want a quick lesson in human rights law, human rights, such as the right to privacy, can only be restricted. The government can only intervene in those rights when necessary, proportionate, and non-discriminatory. Governments may have legitimate interests in protecting people's health, making sure, you know, young children don't use drugs, etc. It is not necessary to achieve that legitimate purpose to criminalize. We can invest in education. We can invest in prevention. We can invest in the provision of voluntary, affordable treatment in the community in a non-coercive way. So it's not necessary to criminalize personal drug use to achieve those legitimate government interests. Second, we know that it's not proportionate. When you are saddling someone with a criminal record that can follow them for the rest of their lives, when you are locking people up in some of the jurisdictions I visited for decades for personal drug use and possession, it is not proportionate. When you are harming families in this way, it is not proportionate. And thirdly, we know it's not non-discriminatory. I just gave you those figures. So it simply fails the human rights analysis. Furthermore, all the harms that we document in these 196 pages of the report implicate other fundamental human rights, such as the right to family, the right to liberty, the right to participate in economic and social life of the society you live in. And so even if we could do this in a non-discriminatory way, even if we could stop rates of drug dependence this way, we're saying this still implicates fundamental human rights and we need to tackle the system because of it.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, it's not, of course, an insult to say that this is not completely untrodden ground, you know, that folks have talked about this before. But I just wonder, in terms of media and perhaps the public conversation, what do we need besides evidence? You know, how do we move it from lamentable to unacceptable?
Absolutely. You're right that much of this is well known in certain ways. I think, number one, the scope of the documentation is very new, and we really hope to contribute there. I think the human rights framework for decriminalization is new, not new in the sense that it hasn't been there the whole time, but new in the sense that we're laying out those arguments. And thirdly, I think our call, it's really a call that should be heard and attended to with utmost urgency right now. And so we join the voices of a number of UN agencies, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the WHO, UNAIDS. We join the call of a number of other advocacy organizations. But I think coming together, the American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights Watch, to say it is time to decriminalize possession for personal use of all illicit drugs is very new, in fact. And we hope that people can hear it today when we have marijuana reform sweeping the country, and so there are models already to look to, when we realize that the current system is broken on so many fronts, again, the incarceration front, the policing front, the racial justice front, and when we see that the opioid epidemic has, you know, shown that drug dependence hasn't been stopped by 45 years of the war on drugs. I think it's new, but I think people's ears are pricked for it.
We've been speaking with Tess Borden, Nyer Fellow at the Human Rights Watch and the American Civil Liberties Union. That report, Every 25 Seconds, The Human Toll of Criminalizing Drug Use in the United States, can be found on both groups' websites, ACLU.org and HRW.org. Tess Borden, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's a pleasure, Janine.
That a holiday honoring a man responsible for the murder, enslavement, and exploitation of indigenous people should be occasion for the arrest of Native Americans acting in defense of water, land, and life is not mere symbolism.
The celebration of Christopher Columbus in U.S. history books and culture is increasingly denounced, not only because of his devastating cruelty, but because of the way the fable erases the Taino people, legitimizing their oppression with an implicit view of history as the story of the winners. In a similar way, what is happening at Standing Rock, where thousands have joined to resist the Dakota Access Pipeline, is a struggle not just between Native people and industry or between industry and the planet, but also, our guest says, a fight about story. Mark Trahant is a journalist and a professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota. He blogs at TrahantReports.com. He joins us now by phone from North Dakota. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mark Trahant.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, you wrote recently about Standing Rock. This is a fight about story and who gets to tell it. What were you getting at with that?
Well, North Dakota has really tried to frame this as an issue of lawlessness, and they keep saying that the sound engineering of the pipeline, it will be safe. Although one of those great ironies is that once they moved it from Bismarck to the north of the reservation, because of water concerns, it changed their argument and undermined their argument, I think, forever. This gets to a broader issue, though, of how we get to a conversation in this country about climate and the idea of what it's going to take to have what has been called a managed decline in fossil fuel use and whether or not we can even have that conversation as a country. As long as we keep building pipelines with minimal regulation, that's going to be impossible.
The state of North Dakota kind of stands in for the broader state in this role. They are just maintaining all of what we see as this protest and this activism they sort of think is going to blow over, or at least that's kind of the story they're telling.
Right. They see it as a temporary thing. And they really view the First Amendment as a limited response where you can hold a sign, but you can't stop a pipeline. And their failure to understand civil disobedience has really been striking.
Yes, and I think if there had been more video cameras there, you know, if folks had seen the use of the dogs and all of that, I mean, it really has been quite amazing. There is this piece of the story that regulation is hobbling the industry here, and that this, with all these tests and going back and going around on the decision, it just represents big government trying to hobble, in this case, the fossil fuel industry. And on that note, you reveal a statement from a U.S. district judge that I think is actually very important. Can you tell listeners what you found in that statement from U.S. District Judge Boasberg?
Sure. He wrote that unlike any other pipeline, such as natural gas pipeline, this entire process does not need federal permitting of any kind. There's no environmental impact statement. There's no real construction in how it affects the Clean Waters Act or the Rivers and Harbors Act. It's just a basic permit where it's supposed to be pro forma. And the industry accepted that. They thought it was going to be just a wink and a nod. In fact, I think one of the most amazing things is they actually started construction without an easement under the river. And so even though they say this is all approved and all done, to this date, they still don't have an easement.
I guess that's what they call skating where the puck's going to be. You know, sometimes industry
right.
is so sure they're going to get the law in their favor that they just go ahead and start doing what they want to do. Well, you note in that same piece that the state of North Dakota and the Army Corps of Engineers have a history of rolling over the tribes in the region, including ignoring treaties. And that reminded me of this New York Times article back in August in which the reporter presented, on the one hand, the pipeline builders, energy transfer partners, who call the project a major step toward the U.S.'s weaning itself off of foreign oil, and then on the other hand, were tribes who, quote, viewed the project as a wounding intrusion onto lands where generations of their ancestors hunted bison, gathered water, and were born and buried, long before treaties and fences stamped a different order onto the plains, close quote. I think that's really slippery to imply that the tribes want to go back to some misty memory before treaties, when actually they would prefer treaties be honored. But I wonder what, in general, you make of that kind of media frame.
I think perhaps the oil industry's most successful framing has been the idea of it's either or, that protesters drive cars, therefore they're being disingenuous. And it really isn't either or. If we're going to meet the Paris Agreement, we've got to start turning things around, and we've got to start reducing consumption rather than increasing. And what steps do we take to make that so? The other part of that story that I think is just extraordinary is that it really is a ruse. This is not just about domestic oil, but it's about being able to sell U.S. oil at shipping points and to getting it to those markets effectively. And it's also a stand-in for making it so there's a connection at some point with the really dirty tar sands oil. So it has these multiple layers of misconceptions, I think.
Yeah, well, some people do seem to see it as really the illustration of, are we going to make keep it in the ground more than a slogan, which it needs to be. And along that line, there have been many kind of hopeful signs. You know, we did see the AFL-CIO come out in support of pipeline construction, but then there were other unions who might have been assumed to also kind of do the workers versus environment thing binary that were another either or that we're forced into sometimes. But they've said, no, you know, we're not going to be pitted against one another as workers who, yes, need jobs, but who also need clean air and water. So do you see some kind of some coalitions that maybe look new and maybe look hopeful in this?
I think we're beginning to see that. And especially when you start doing the math to look at, one, what the real cost of the climate is and making sure that it's a broad overall picture. But the second is to look at job creation. The jobs being created in clean energy are actually greater than the oil industry. And that's a potential for workers that I think is just beginning to be tapped.
Dakota Access is a story and the election is a story, but you don't really see the twain meeting so much. I take it you think that's a missing bridge that we ought to see journalists doing more, showing the connections between voting and what's going on at Standing Rock.
Absolutely. I mean, just the idea of how we're going to get forward on this. And voting is part of a national conversation, but this is the conversation about what we're going to do next to try to, if anything else, meet our international obligations, but more important, save the planet.
All right, then. Thank you very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Mark Trahant, professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota. You can find him online at trahantreports.com. Mark Trahant, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Great to be with you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network or to show support for FAIR if you're so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio Eco Shock. Here's just a taste of the heavy hitters in this week's program.
The planet itself would stop absorbing carbon dioxide overall by about 2070. And after that, the planet would begin to emit carbon dioxide. And that's the point at which you've crossed that threshold. And even if we stopped all human emissions of carbon dioxide, the planet itself would be releasing carbon dioxide because it's so damaged. And that's when you're into the realms of runaway or irreversible climate change. So as I say, that turning point was assumed in that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report to be round about 2040. The work that I've done shows that it actually happened in 2006. It happened 10 years ago.
That's Professor James Curran from Scotland, formerly the head of the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency. Curran has published new science. It shakes our planning for climate change to the core. The plants, it seems, are soaking up less and less of the carbon dioxide we pump into the sky. Peak carbon is not later in this century, as predicted, but behind us. It's stunning news that makes climate action so much more urgent than you've been told. Then,
once fossil fuel consumption changes, it will also change the distribution of power. And I think this is the central anxiety that actually prevents countries like the United States and Australia and so on from moving on climate change. It's not about lifestyles in the end. I think it's really about who gets to, as it were, run the world system.
You will hear from one of India's best-known authors in both fiction and nonfiction. Amitav Ghosh has just released his newest book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change, and the Unthinkable. In a wide-ranging interview, we look at climate change from the other side of the world. In the news, climate scientists are already at work analyzing the role of climate change in deadly Hurricane Matthew. It was the strongest storm to hit the Caribbean and America's East Coast in a decade. The seas there were about 3 degrees or more hotter than usual. That gave it energy. And then the warmer atmosphere was overloaded with extra water vapor. We'll await the postmortem. In this program, Amitav Ghosh does talk about the modern migration of humans to the sea coasts, just at the time when perhaps that becomes the most dangerous place to be. Unreported, except in the Siberian Times, scientists have found still more methane leaking from frozen deposits on the shallow seabeds of the East Russian Arctic. Professor Igor Semilyatov of Tomsk Polytechnic University returned on a Russian research ship. He found significantly more methane escaping than measured on earlier trips from 2011 to 2014. The methane amounts are not yet at a panic level, but it is at a danger sign from one of the most likely sources of a rapid climate shift. A big methane burst could power rapid global warming. Thanks to our guest scientist Paul Beckwith for that tip. In a new report, The Truth About Climate Change, top-level scientists say that the 2-degree danger mark we've all been looking at has moved forward in time, from the end of this century to 2050. As Ian Johnson writes in The Independent, quote, "It means the majority of people alive today will experience what it is like to live on a dangerously overheated planet," end quote. I think we're there already. I'll try to find out more on that for you. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get to our interviews. Most of the land on Earth is in the Northern Hemisphere. What if all the plants there started to capture less and less carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? Surely that couldn't happen. Our guest was the chief executive for the Scottish Environment Protection Agency, or SEPA. Now James Curran is co-author of a new study published in the journal Weather. The title is An Estimate of the Climate Change Significance of the Decline in the Northern Hemisphere's Uptake of Carbon Dioxide in Biomass. It's not good news. Professor James Curran, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be with you.
Let's talk about your new paper. How can we possibly know how much carbon dioxide the totality of plant life in the Northern Hemisphere can inhale, so to speak?
Well, it's interesting. And as you said in your introduction, I recently retired as chief executive of the Scottish Environment Protection Agency. But for a while before that, I'd been thinking about how to set about looking at the way the atmosphere is responding to basically vegetation, the terrestrial vegetation. And I was very keen as soon as I retired to take a look at it. If you look at the records of atmospheric carbon dioxide that are measured at the summit of the Mauna Loa mountain in Hawaii, that's the Mauna Loa Observatory, where daily measurements are made, and they're all available online. So anyone can look at these. And if you look at them, carbon dioxide, obviously, as we well know, has been increasing steadily year by year since the measurements at that site began in 1957. Now, that's a particularly good site because it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's high up on a mountain near the equator, way, way, long way away from any other kind of land masses. So you get a very good representative sample of planetary carbon dioxide there. As I say, it's been increasing steadily year by year. But if you look at the detail of that, what it does is the carbon dioxide increases during the Northern Hemisphere winter and then decreases during the Northern Hemisphere summer. So there's a kind of little ripple, an annual ripple in that rising trend. That ripple is because, as you said yourself, most of the landmass of the Earth is in the Northern Hemisphere. During the summer, the leaves come out on the bushes and the trees. Trees grow bigger. Crops, even our own human crops, grow. And all of those suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in order to increase the amount of plant mass, the biomass, as it's called, in all the ecosystems across the Northern Hemisphere. As we approach Northern Hemisphere winter, it's very obvious the leaves fall off the trees, they land on the ground, and then they begin to decay. And as that plant matter decays, it releases carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So during the Northern Hemisphere winter, planetary carbon dioxide levels increase again. So by studying this little ripple in the Mauna Loa observatories, this ripple that occurs every year, summer to winter, you can then begin to estimate how much the biosphere, specifically in the Northern Hemisphere, but that's the greatest part of the Earth's biosphere, is reacting over the time period of all those measurements being available, which is 1957 right up to the present.
And what did you find?
Well, that was interesting. I mean, first of all, I was a meteorologist originally and moved gradually into the environment. So I was pretty sure when I decided I'd really love to look at this that someone else would have already done that study. Turns out a couple of people did it many, many years ago, but they were looking at it for other reasons and didn't have this particular test in mind. So I looked at it, and what I found is that drop in planetary atmospheric carbon dioxide, which happens every Northern Hemisphere summer, has gradually changed. Now, originally in the kind of 1960s and 1970s, that drop in the Northern Hemisphere summer was getting bigger. That's because it has been fairly well kind of assumed and understood that as you put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from man-made activities, and as the Earth slightly warms, then vegetation actually gets more active because carbon dioxide is a kind of fertilizer to vegetation. And it did. So that drop, showing the activity of the Northern Hemisphere biosphere, increased over the kind of 1960s, 1970s. But interestingly, that activity, that biomass activity, peaked in 2006 and has slightly dropped since then. So we've gone beyond this kind of peak carbon absorption, this peak ability of the planet to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. Now, that is really, really scary.
And you say it dropped slightly. How would that compare to human emissions, say, from countries?
Okay, well, this is a little bit complicated, and maybe I'm not awfully good at explaining it, but I'll do my best. during the 60s and 70s, the Earth was getting better and better at sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So as man-made emissions were increasing then, the Earth was sucking a bit more carbon dioxide each year out of the atmosphere and locking it up in tree trunks, in the soil, because plants put a lot of carbon down into the soils and so on, and taking it out of the atmosphere, locking it away safely and pretty permanently. As I say, that ability has now peaked and is beginning to decline. And if it had gone on increasing as it did year by year in the 60s and 70s, we'd be in a much, much better position now because the Earth would be more efficient at slowing down climate change, at slowing down the rate at which carbon dioxide is accumulating in the atmosphere because of all of our polluting activities. That decreasing ability is exactly equivalent to us having actually added on, without us really realizing it, 30% of human man-made emissions. That's equivalent to adding on another China in terms of emissions. So the end result is that atmospheric carbon dioxide is now increasing as fast as if we'd added in another China compared to what it would have if the biomass hadn't been beginning to fail. That's a huge impact. And it explains something that has been a little bit of a mystery recently, that atmospheric carbon dioxide is increasing faster than ever at the moment on planet Earth at a time when we're just beginning to get a grip on man-made emissions. And over the last kind of 2 or 3 years, man-made emissions have begun just about to flatline after having risen year after year after year. And that's been a bit of a mystery. Why is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rising faster than ever, but our own emissions are more or less beginning to stabilize? And I think it's because of this, because the planet is beginning to fail to take carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere and lock it up.
I've had oceanographers say the same thing, that they feel that the oceans are reaching their limit and they won't be able to absorb the greenhouse gases that they have been doing. So it's kind of a 1-2 punch we're talking about here.
Nice way of putting it, 1-2 punch, absolutely. I mean, none of this is kind of brand new. What made me start thinking about this, many years ago, I was asked by the UK government to be an independent reviewer of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change when they produced their assessment report number 4. That was back in 2007. There's been an update since then. And buried in the thousands of pages of that, I think, absolutely brilliant report was a little graph that showed the kind of modeled, anticipated behavior of all the terrestrial ecosystems of the planet in their ability to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And what that modeling did, and out of that you then predict what's going to happen to planetary carbon dioxide, it was suggested that the ability of the ecosystems to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere would be at a peak round about 2070. It would then begin to decline because ecosystems get hit by climate change. It gets too hot for lots of plants to survive. There's lots of droughts and floods that damage natural vegetation as well as crops. There's wildfires, and we hear more and more about those, which destroy the plants. Also can set fire to high carbon soils, peatlands and so on, releasing carbon dioxide. Numerous of these kind of positive feedback effects. These would kick in from 2070 onwards. The planet itself would stop absorbing carbon dioxide overall by about 2070. And after that, the planet would begin to emit carbon dioxide. And that's the point at which you've crossed that threshold. And even if we stopped all human emissions of carbon dioxide, the planet itself would be releasing carbon dioxide because it's so damaged. And that's when you're into the realms of runaway or irreversible climate change. So as I say, that turning point was assumed in that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report to be round about 2040. The work that I've done shows that it actually happened in 2006. It happened 10 years ago. So we've really got to take that very, very seriously and do everything we can, not just to reduce our man-made emissions, but actually to try and repair the broken planet, to get biodiversity functioning again, to get our biomass up, to get ecosystems functioning as they should.
Well, one small question. My listeners in Australia and New Zealand will wonder why the study isn't global, including the Southern Hemisphere.
It's because if you look at those data from the Mauna Loa Observatory, it is the Northern Hemisphere that's absolutely dominating. It's that that produces this ripple in the carbon dioxide values year on year. It's because, as you said yourself, the vast amount of land, and particularly productive vegetated land, is in the Northern Hemisphere. There's not so much land in the Southern Hemisphere, and quite a bit of it, like Central Australia, I haven't been there, but I believe, and I've seen pictures of it, it's fairly desert, so it's not very active at taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That's the reason.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Scottish professor James Curran. He's found that plants are taking in less carbon dioxide in recent years, and in fact, as we've just heard, we may be looking in the rearview mirror at peak carbon. Well, except for being frozen in permafrost, isn't most of the carbon captured by plant life eventually released back into the air, as you said?
Well, no. I mean, the plants are very effective at clearly increasing their own biomass. The trunks of trees get bigger as they grow. They put more branches on and so on. So there's more and more carbon being taken up in the plant itself. But an awful lot of carbon is fed down through the roots and is sequestered or locked up in the soils through many kind of carbon-based chemicals that are left in the soil. So soils accumulate carbon, the plant material itself accumulates carbon. The kind of volatile bit is predominantly the leaves that fall off in the winter, lie on the land surface, the soil surface, and then decay, biodegrade, releasing carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So an awful lot of the plant material pretty kind of permanently sequesters carbon away, certainly on the kind of timescales that we're thinking of, which is hopefully hundreds or thousands of years. But eventually, a lot of it will end up forming peat deposits. And I'm speaking from Scotland, where we have enormous peat deposits. Our kind of iconic heather moorlands are all based on peat deposits underneath that can be many feet deep. And in Scotland, that peat resource actually holds billions of tons of carbon in the peat. And that's quite an interesting example of potential climate feedback, because Scotland is kind of, I suppose, semi-notorious for having a cold, wet climate, and that's why peat is created. Climate change would suggest that in Scotland we're going to get warmer, and in the summer, drier. That is very, very damaging to peat bogs if they dry out. And in fact, the peat breaks up, it cracks open, air gets in, and it begins to decay and release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So it's those kind of processes that we need to worry about, that climate change feedback, climate change causing perturbations to our ecosystems that then themselves start releasing carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So climate change worsening climate change itself.
Yes, peat fires should cause us all to break into a bit of a sweat. There were peat fires outside of Moscow in the Russian 2010 fires, and the 1997-98 peat fires in Indonesia took that country to be, I think it was the second or third largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world just from the peat fires that they had.
That's right. I mean, another worrying aspect of climate change feedback. These, we hear more and more about wildfires. Even in Alaska, there's been some quite big wildfires recently which burn off the vegetation and then can get actually into the high carbon soils underneath, and the soils burn for a long, long time afterwards, as you rightly say, releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that's taken hundreds, if not thousands of years to build up.
Well, you've talked about getting this cycle going again so that we can capture carbon with plants. We've all heard about plans to stimulate plankton growth as a way to increase carbon capture. Professor Curran, given the scale of nature's operations, do you think we'll find ways to reverse the decline in plant capture?
Well, I sincerely hope so. I mean, through my professional life, I've sat on numerous kind of biodiversity committees here in Scotland, trying to either stabilize biodiversity or hopefully reverse the decline and start rebuilding biodiversity. Scotland kind of cares about the environment quite deeply. We have a government that produces all the right kind of statutory documents and strategic plans and so on. But it really, really, with the best will in the world, doesn't seem to be working awfully well. There's a well-known approach all around the world in many, many countries to designate particular sites and particular habitats and protect them, or to designate particular species and try and look after them. There's loads of green and environmental NGOs that work endlessly protecting particular interests and so on. But yeah, thinking about that approach, it's quite fragmented, isn't it? Lots of goodwill, lots of enthusiasm, but it's fragmented. And it really, at the end of the day, just doesn't seem to be working. Biodiversity around the world, and even here in Scotland, at best is in some places kind of stable. At worst, in many places, is declining. So I think we probably need to begin to think about completely different approaches. And again, this isn't brand new thinking, but there's accumulating evidence, some really good scientific studies, that if you start joining up what remains of natural habitats or semi-natural habitats with corridors, you connect them with managed corridors so that species can translocate and move around and so on, then you begin to get a real resurgence in biodiversity. And I think we've got to begin to look at really strategic, big scale, landscape scale, national scale, strategic rebuilding of corridors between the wild parts of that we have remaining. I'd love to see us experiment with that here in Scotland. I think we have a very good opportunity to connect up two of our biggest national parks with corridors joining up our natural or semi-natural habitats. And allied to that, you know, there's a growing concept of rewilding the landscape, allowing it to become more the kind of natural vegetation, the assemblage of species and plants and so on that would occur under more natural circumstances. And that, again, bolsters the ability of those ecosystems to absorb carbon. It improves their sequestration capability for carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So I think we've really got to start thinking much bigger and change our policy and legislative approach to how we try and preserve. And now we certainly need to rebuild biodiversity right across the planet.
Part of that plant life is agriculture, and if we change some of our means of agriculture so that we don't lose so much carbon from the soil and, in fact, put some back in the soil, I think that's another hope for us.
Oh, you're dead right about that. There's lots of implications, potentially, for the way we manage our agriculture. Agriculture, certainly here in Europe, is highly subsidized with a lot of state aid, and I think that state aid needs to be increasingly directed to low-carbon agriculture, kind of zero-tillage agriculture. If you just plow up huge areas of land to plant crops in, it's very damaging. That releases a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, whereas if you do zero-tillage, you just plant the individual crop plants into the soil, you don't do wide-scale plowing, then immediately you can save a lot on carbon releases. So there's lots of way agriculture and farmers can very positively contribute to making us all safe from climate change in the future. And I think that'll have to come. That is already beginning, but we need to accelerate it and be much more ambitious in that regard.
I think it's going to be difficult to get your new science out to the general public, and that's partly because the news is pretty awful to believe. What happens if the decline continues?
Well, as I say, it's very worrying if that decline goes on continuing, and I would certainly hope that many others start looking at some of these aspects and doing different experiments looking at this issue of declining ecosystem ability to lock up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We need to look at it from different ways, doing different experiments to try and substantiate it, to put a scale on it, and through that to identify the ways that we can intervene and hopefully reverse this positive feedback element to climate change. If we don't, then we are headed for accelerating carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Our own efforts to minimize man-made emissions, which are, you know, there's been great progress there. The COP21 agreement in Paris is about to become now the single greatest global treaty that man has ever managed. I mean, that's something to be hugely proud of. But potentially, that's in the face of another adverse impact that is going on that we haven't really been aware of. So we need to really, really up our game when it comes to implementing the Paris Agreement and up our game when it comes to protecting our planetary ecosystems. If not, we are facing, as I said earlier, the potential for irreversible climate change, which is hugely damaging to us, to man. We don't know what we'll be facing. And anyone who believes in the precautionary principle, as I do, would not want to go anywhere near that kind of trigger point.
Well, in the news, Scottish Environment Secretary Rosanna Cunningham has urged the UK government to sign the Paris Climate Agreement. Do you personally really think the Paris Agreement can keep global warming below 2 degrees C?
I believe that there is an opportunity. I think the Paris Agreement is a huge breakthrough. I attended the Copenhagen summit along with a ministerial delegation from Scotland, and I was so devastated at the failure of that conference to come to any useful agreement. This one in Paris, I only watched on the TV, and I'll be honest, I was crying when it was finally agreed. I think it's a huge breakthrough, down to French diplomatic genius, I think. So the opportunity is there. What we've now got to do through programs such as yourselves is bring the message home to people that Paris Agreement is the door. It's the doorway to a better future. We've got to walk through that doorway now and take every opportunity to reverse the journey we've been on since the Industrial Revolution.
Professor Curran, what is next for you now?
What's next for me? As I said, I get quite excited about some of these big projects. I've spent a lot of my life thinking about climate change and also thinking about sustainable development. What I want to do is to try and get some momentum and some motivation behind a possible project here in Scotland to create a strategic joining up of our ecosystems right up the centre of Scotland. I'm proud that Scottish Government has some of the leading climate change mitigation legislation anywhere in the world, a 42% reduction in man-made emissions in Scotland by 2020. We've met that target 6 years early, because the latest data are for 2014. So we're exceeding the target. Scottish Government is putting in place even more stretching targets for reducing our man-made emissions by 2020 and beyond. I'd like to see my country trying to take a lead in rewilding and reconnection of our ecosystems and habitats here in Scotland. And I think we could do it, and I want to be part of that if I can.
I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with Professor James Curran, the former head of the Environment Agency, SEPA, in Scotland. And now with Sun Samuel, James has investigated the big picture of carbon capture by plants in the Northern Hemisphere. It is declining dangerously. Find links to the full paper and to James Curran in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. James Curran, I've enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
And you, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Heating up a small planet affects everyone, everywhere, no matter who releases the greenhouse gases. I'm always looking for voices outside the bubble of the Western-style consumer culture. Our next guest was born in the Indian megacity of Calcutta. He studied at the Delhi School of Economics and got his PhD at Oxford. Currently, when he has settled anywhere, Amitav Ghosh lives in New York. But Ghosh is most widely known for his writing. His best-selling novels make him one of the souls of India. His mastery of fiction and nonfiction make him a bridge to English readers as well. Here's a powerful introduction of Amitav Ghosh, recorded at the launch of his new book, The Great Derangement. It was in his birthplace of Calcutta.
I am Jagushini. Amitabh Ghosh is the author of such acclaimed fiction as The Circle of Reason, which was, of course, his debut novel, The Shadow Lines, The Calcutta Chromosome, The Glass Palace, The Hungry Tide, and the Ibis trilogy, Sea of Poppies, River of Smoke, and Flood of Fire. His notable non-fiction writings are In an Antique Land, Dancing in Cambodia and at Large in Burma, Countdown, and The Imam and the Indian. In The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, which is Amitabh's first major book of non-fiction since In an Antique Land, he examines our inability at the level of literature, history, and politics to grasp the scale and violence of climate change. The climate crisis asks us to imagine other forms of human existence, a task to which fiction, Amitabh argues, is the best suited of all cultural forms. His book serves as a great writer's summons to confront the most urgent task of our time.
That recording is from the book launch August 1st, 2016, in Calcutta. On YouTube, you can find the whole thought-provoking conversation between Amitabh Ghosh and filmmaker Srijit Mukherjee. And I'll put links in my show blog at ecoshock.info so you can find it.
Radio EcoShock.
Amitabh Ghosh, it's an honor to have you join us on Radio EcoShock. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. It's a great pleasure to be with you. I listen to your show all the time. I have the podcast downloaded on my phone, so this is really an honor for me.
Well, I'm really surprised, and I'm really pleased, of course. And it is a good source of climate science news, I think. Now, to get going here, I was in Mumbai back in 1979 when it was still called by its colonial name of Bombay. And since then, you know, the population has doubled to almost 21 million in Metro Mumbai today. Tell us about the risks of climate change to this mega city.
Well, Mumbai is in an extraordinarily vulnerable location, you know, because it's just completely exposed to the sea. It's built on these reclaimed islands. So most of Mumbai is actually, you know, built on reclaimed land now. South Mumbai was, you know, initially just a set of islands, and they've now been linked together. The real problem for Mumbai is two things. One is sea level rise, of course. But the other major problem for Mumbai is that cyclonic activity is increasing greatly in the Arabian Sea. In the past, Bombay, Portuguese Bombay, as well as British Bombay, the city was hit by cyclones fairly regularly. This didn't happen in the 20th century, but it seems that now with the uptick in cyclonic activity in the Arabian Sea, that Mumbai may well be hit in the years to come.
And you've suggested buildings could collapse in the city.
Buildings collapse in Mumbai, as you know, also in other Indian cities and other Asian cities. Buildings collapse anyway. It happens fairly often. And these buildings are not built to resist extraordinary wind speeds or anything of that kind. So, yes, I think if Mumbai were to face a storm like Hurricane Matthew, the results would be completely catastrophic.
And is the city prepared if a storm like Hurricane Sandy hit it?
Not at all. The city is not prepared at all. I went through all the disaster preparation documents that the city has produced. The disaster that Mumbai is preparing for is actually yesterday's disaster, as it were, you know, which was this terrible, this extreme rainfall event that occurred in 2005. When, you know, the city got something like 36 inches of rain in 14 hours. And there were terrible floods after that and so on. So after that, you know, the city government did try to take cognizance of what had happened, and they've tried to create some documents around it. But that sort of event and a major cyclone would be completely different in their impact.
And Mumbai has a nuclear power plant on either side of it, and I'm worried that a terrible event like the meltdowns in Fukushima, Japan, could happen in India. I mean, all that has to happen is the power grid goes down for long enough, their batteries run out, they can't get their diesel fuel through, and those things can melt down. Is that a genuine fear?
It's certainly a fear for me. It's a fear for me. It's a fear for others who study nuclear safety issues. In a sense, one doesn't want to be excessively alarmist because, as you know, it sort of makes people's minds shut down. So I don't want to sort of be raising a hue and cry about that, but it's certainly a very, very, it's a possibility. It's something that could happen.
Well, this sort of dovetails into your book title. You said that climate change is to some degree unthinkable.
I think, yes, climate change is unthinkable according to the manners and procedures of thought that we've developed over the last 200 years. It resists our ways of thinking in many different ways. But equally unthinkable are the sorts of responses it requires from us, you know, managed retreat, changing our lives, changing the ways in which we deal with our ordinary circumstances. Everything in our life, in our collective lives, is really interrogated and questioned and challenged by climate change in a way that has never happened in any other circumstance, I think.
And you recently returned from Chennai on the east coast of India. Tell us about the extreme rainfall event that struck there.
There again, there was this extreme, what they now call a rain bomb. So there was this sort of rain bomb event. Suddenly, you know, a stalled system dumping huge quantities of water on Chennai. The problem for India, of course, is that not just India, but many places in the world, is that human impact and climate impact have both accumulated to the point where really they're both exacerbating each other, you know. So in Chennai, actually, many of the activists don't even really want to talk about the climate change impact because, you know, they're so focused on criticizing the political structures of the city, on focusing on its patterns of development, very misdirected development, where they've built over drainage channels, clogged up, you know, old rivers and creeks and the wetlands. So, you know, in some strange way, because people are focused on that and they should be focused on that, they sometimes don't even want to hear about the climate change impact. Another problem really in relation to India is that, you know, well, not just in relation to India, as you know, really climate science, the whole discourse around climate change tends to be very, very Eurocentric. It's almost completely focused on the West. So attribution studies, for example, really haven't paid much attention to Asia and or other parts of the world. There's been no attribution study, so far as I know, of this rain bomb event in Chennai or even the event that occurred in Mumbai in 2005.
Have the city planners and the developers changed their ways in Chennai to avoid a repeat?
On the contrary, you know, just at the time that I was releasing my book in Chennai, somebody told me this astonishing fact that a developer has just announced a super luxury condominium building, actually in one of the most vulnerable spots. It's at the mouth of a river and, you know, a few hundred yards from the sea. And this super luxury condo is going to have a 7-story basement. What can you say, really? I mean, it's just another symptom of the derangement that we live in.
It is a kind of madness. You know, whether it's Chennai or Miami Beach or New Jersey, after every flood, people and, of course, the politicians promise to rebuild everything exactly in the same dangerous places. How can we go on living in this dream, knowing what we do know from the science of climate change?
It completely boggles the mind, really. I mean, just today, I was reading in a journal article, Dutch engineers talking about Miami, and the word they all used for Miami is doomed. At the same time, you know, some part of my screen, there was an ad going off for this super luxury building on Miami Beach. And people are apparently buying into these buildings. They are making investments in these properties. What can you say? It's really a metaphor for the strange state of mind that we're all in.
And yet, you think literature has somewhat turned away from climate change?
Yes, I think literature has. And that's really what my new book is about. It's about the ways in which climate change really resists the literary forms and even the artistic forms of our time, you know. Because basically these forms were invented in the 19th century, in the early 20th and the mid 20th centuries, when we lived through a period of relative climatic stability. And now, you know, we are in this moment when, you know, the climate is anything but stable. And our forms just haven't caught up. Our forms haven't even begun to catch up. I'll give you an example, if you like.
Please.
I was in Mumbai, again, talking about my book. And I was speaking to a couple, they're very famous artists, very famous, very successful, globally successful artists. And they were telling me about their experiences during the deluge of 2005. Their house was swamped, they lost a lot of work, their child was stranded and they couldn't reach her for 2 days. So it was a traumatic experience for them, you know, in every sense a trauma. And I asked them, I said, so has this trauma in any way found its way into your work? Have you expressed it in your work? And they were both astonished by the question. I mean, not only had they not addressed this trauma, you know, those floods in their work, the very thought hadn't occurred to them. And the real reason for this is that, you know, if an artist of that stature addresses something like that, then it's considered illustrative. You know, it's considered to be an illustration, if you like, of surroundings or whatever. And that illustration is now a real pejorative in the vocabulary of art criticism. And if the pejorative had been applied to their work, they would have lost their market. Their work would not have been taken seriously from that point on. So do you see what I'm saying? We have reached a point where really our art, the very mode of our art, refused to let us engage with our surroundings.
A serious situation. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is the legendary author Amitav Ghosh with his new book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. In your book, you trace your own beginning path to climate awareness to a strange weather event in Delhi. Tell us about that.
Yes. Let me say straight away that weather event had no connection to climate change that I know of. This happened in 1978, so a long time ago. It was a day of very strange weather in Delhi University. I was a student there. I was also working as a journalist. I was in a library. And, you know, the weather was so strange. Suddenly, there was a hailstorm and it stopped. So I decided to go back to the room that I was living in. And I took a very unusual route, a route that I didn't usually take because I wanted to just stop by and see a friend. And the weather kept getting worse. So then I sort of headed off. And as I was walking down a road, I glanced over my shoulder and I saw this strange sort of like a finger reaching down from the sky. And as I was watching, it sort of came whiplashing down to earth, you know, behind me on this road. So I ran for cover. I first went to this big plate glass door. There were many people cowering there, and there was no room for me. So then I went around to the side, and I sort of took shelter under an overhang. After a while, there was this incredible noise. I looked up, and I saw things just whirling through the sky, you know. Tea stalls, bicycles, asbestos roofs, because there were a lot of asbestos roofs in Delhi in those days. And it just lasted a moment, and then it was over. And it was, of course, a tornado. But a tornado had never before struck Delhi. Tornadoes are completely unfamiliar in that part of the world. So, you know, none of us even knew what to call it. The next day, in the newspapers, it was called a cyclone. In fact, because nobody knew the right word for it. But it killed 30 people. Many of the people who were around me were injured. So I was extraordinarily fortunate. But you know, I've written about this in the book because what I was trying to address is this idea of the unprecedented, you know, the unfamiliar, the uncanny. Because just think about it. There I was walking down a street, and suddenly a completely unprecedented, a historically unprecedented phenomenon suddenly touches down right on top of me almost, you know. And for years afterwards, I tried to write about it, but its very unlikeliness, the very nature of the phenomenon was such that I couldn't actually bring myself to put it into a book. Because, you know, how in novels it's often said that if you put this in a book, nobody would believe it. And that's actually the case, that the sort of whole calculus of probability that exists in contemporary fiction is such that even ordinarily unlikely events become very difficult to put into a book because they just seem so improbable. And in my book, the argument that I make is that it's this calculus of probability that is in itself one of the factors about climate change that resists the techniques of the modern novel.
And you read a lot of science for your 2004 fiction book, The Hungry Tide. What was that book about?
Well, the book is about, the book is set in the Sundarbans, the vast mangrove forest in India. It's actually in Bengal, and I am myself by origin a Bengali. And I spent a lot of time in this forest, even as a child, because one of my uncles worked in it. And I've been returning to it over the years. So my book, The Hungry Tide, is actually about an Indian-American cephalologist, specialist on marine mammals, a young girl who's doing research for her PhD. And she goes to the Sundarbans to study the Irrawaddy dolphin, you know, which is it's a freshwater dolphin, though some members also live in saltwater. So she goes there and she encounters, again, a cyclone. This is a very cyclone-prone region. So, that's the general background.
An awe-inspiring part of your thoughts, I think, on climate involves a still larger pattern of populations all over the world moving towards the seas at the exact time in history when that is a very dangerous place to be, the interface between the seas and the land. Why do you think that migration away from the inland agricultural lands happened?
Well, one of the obvious reasons, of course, is the intensification of trade. And the argument that I make in the book is that if you look at, say, pre-17th century cities, even the major ports were not built directly on the sea. I mean, like London, for example, you know, it's separated from the sea by a long stretch of the River Thames. That's true of Guangzhou. It's true of many of major port cities, ancient port cities of Asia. Really, the whole trend of building cities right on the sea starts under the European expansion that begins, you know, the 16th century onwards. And many of the cities that are now most threatened were actually built in the 17th century. So, for example, New York and Mumbai come into the possession of the British Empire in the 1660s. And these are both cities that are now directly threatened by climate change. But again, you have in the 19th century another major wave of city building. Again, many cities were built right on the water in this period. In the U.S., of course, you have Chicago, then there's Singapore, Hong Kong, many other cities are like that. And these cities, again, are today extremely at risk from sea level rise. So in the book, I'm just sort of tracing these patterns of how is it that at a certain point in time, people suddenly decide that it's a good idea to live close to the sea. And as we see now, you know, this pattern is actually accelerating. More and more people are moving closer and closer to the sea. And the consequences in the long run are certainly going to be disastrous.
Yes, I'm told that about 50% of the American population now live within 100 miles of either the Atlantic or the Pacific coast. Well, Amitav, we've talked a lot about rising seas and storms, but global warming does mean global warming. And just this summer, India experienced its hottest temperature ever recorded. What is the threat of heat to India?
It's enormous. I mean, the temperatures this summer were unprecedented. I mean, like 51 degrees centigrade, you know, not far from Delhi. Delhi and, cities near Calcutta experienced temperatures of 47 to 49 degrees centigrade. These are temperatures in the 120s in Fahrenheit, temperatures at which really people can't be exposed to the sun for more than 15, 20 minutes without becoming completely dehydrated. But there are two things that are very interesting about these heat waves. One is that, of course, the heat wave also coincided with this epic drought, where hundreds of thousands of farmers from certain interior regions in India started abandoning their lands and moving to cities. Literally, in a very short period, millions of farmers left their land and moved to the cities. You know, what we don't realize about these migrations is that when a traditional farmer, someone who's farmed all their lives and who knows by observing their fathers and their grandfathers and grandmothers, farming the land, they learn all these techniques. So when they move away,
really we lose a huge amount of agricultural knowledge. And this knowledge can never be restored. Those people will probably now settle in the cities. They'll never go back to their farmlands. And, you know, a huge trove of knowledge is lost. And this is something that's happening not just in India, but also in the U.S. You know, last year I was invited to the University of Indiana, you know, to talk about my books and so on. But I had some very interesting interactions with the students there. Now, as you know, the University of Indiana was originally an agricultural institution with a great focus on agriculture. And many of the students are from rural Indiana. And I was talking to them and I said, so what do you guys want to do in the future? How many of you are from a farming background? And many of them, maybe more than half, were from farming backgrounds. So I asked them, what do you want to do in the future? And all of them, literally all of them said, we want to move to New York, you know. So if this gigantic migration takes place and continues to accelerate, I think we're looking at a circumstance where really who's going to be left to produce the food?
Monsanto.
Monsanto. That's exactly it. You know, there's a huge sort of hemorrhaging of human capital and human knowledge that's occurring and that we are not paying attention to. The other thing which really struck me about the heat wave in India, I was in Delhi, very shortly after the heat wave, and I had a meeting with some young journalists. There were 30 or 40 very bright young journalists there. And we were talking, about climate change and so on. And I asked them, I said, how many of you wrote about the heat wave? And, you know, a couple of them had, written short pieces about the temperatures. But there were no other stories. You know, none of them had written any sort of long-form story. None of them had, even gone out and reported about it. And I think that is really the problem. How do you write a story, even just a journalistic story, about a heat wave? What's your story? How do you put people in it? And this is where I think really, the arts are failing us. Literature is failing us. If the great literary minds of our time can't think of these stories, how can you expect, busy, rushed young journalists to go out and tell these stories?
Amitav Ghosh, you don't think highly of the climate agreement reached in Paris in late 2015. Why not?
Well, in the first place, there are multiple reasons. I don't think it's actually going to achieve the goals that it claims to. But anyway, I'm not an expert on that. I think to me there are two things which are really profoundly disappointing about this agreement. One is that it makes literally almost no mention of climate justice. There's only one sentence in it where climate justice is obscurely referred to, and it's sort of parenthesized as something which is of interest only to a few. As we know, justice is absolutely a central issue in climate change, and it has, if in effect, what this Paris Agreement achieved was to sweep the whole issue of justice under the carpet. So that is really one major problem as far as I'm concerned. The second major problem is that nowhere in the document do they even speak of climate change as a market failure, which actually occurred in the Kyoto Protocol and in earlier iterations of these agreements. But here it's completely absent. So there's no question here. Never is the question confronted that should we change our lifestyles? Do we need to think about our ways of living in new and alternative forms? Those questions are never broached. They're never addressed. In fact, what this Paris Agreement does, in my view, is that it's a direct descendant of, all these other free trade agreements like TARP and NAFTA and so on. It deploys exactly the same language. And what it's aimed at is really, it's aimed at creating business opportunities around climate change. So in a way, what it is that it's a neoliberalization of climate change. And I think, that's not going to help or work in the long run.
I think we'll still go well over 2 degrees with that, if that's our best hope. And speaking of hope, do you think there is hope for us?
That's the question that actually I've heard you asking many of the scientists that you interview.
And I think they're much better placed to address it than I am. But one thing I've certainly noticed is that, you know, where on the question of hope, the answers that you usually get from climate scientists and so on is geared actually to politics more than to actuality, as it were. I mean, there are people who feel that if you present a sort of panicky view of what's ahead, then that's unfruitful. On the other hand, there are people who feel that unless you raise the alarm, people won't respond. As far as I can see, neither of these approaches has worked.
Yes, well, you call it the Great Derangement, so obviously you're quite concerned.
Yes, of course. But I really admire activists like Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, and so on, and I really admire the work they do, and I try and support it in whatever way, but I don't think of myself as an activist.
Well, I think writing is an activist act, and certainly you'll communicate with millions of people with your new book. As we end our time together, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
But first, I think one of the most important things I'm trying to say in the book is that, you know, the whole sort of climate issue has been increasingly sort of conceptualized as a matter of wealth, you know. People don't want to sacrifice their wealth. That's why they deny climate change and so on. This is a position that you'll hear many activists take. But I think what is even more important than wealth in this matter is actually power. What underlies the global distribution of power today is fossil fuels in many ways. And once fossil fuel consumption changes, it will also change the distribution of power. And I think this is the central anxiety that actually prevents countries like the United States and Australia and so on from moving on climate change. It's not about lifestyles in the end. I think it's really about who gets to, as it were, run the world system.
The fiction and nonfiction works of Amitav Ghosh are read by many millions of people. His latest is a deeply thought-out look at the inner and outer perils of climate change. It's called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. You can find out more at amitavghosh.com or find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. If I may just point out, the book is published in the U.S. by the University of Chicago Press.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Be sure to check out my website at ecoshock.org for all our past programs. You can download those shows with some of the world's top scientists, authors, and activists, all for free, thanks to support from our listeners. Please take the opportunity to get educated about our future and the ways to save it. The Radio EcoShock Weekly blog is also there with loads of links to everything we've talked about. You can check out the sources for yourself and explore the big questions. Don't miss it at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world. This is a compilation of the song Brand New Sky from soilforclimate.org.
We don't have to settle for a dying planet. This is Jeff Blankford with the October 12th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. On this day, 524 years ago, Christopher Columbus and his crew were discovered on the shores of what is today San Salvador by the indigenous people who lived there. And not being European and familiar with their ways of the world, they welcomed the visitors and naively showered them with gifts sufficient to convince Columbus that greater riches awaited on future voyages. A year and a month later, on November 19, 1493, Columbus, backed by the King and Queen of Spain, returned, this time landing on what is today called Puerto Rico. And he came not with three ships as before, but with 17 ships, 1,500 men, plus European livestock, cattle, sheep, and horses. The story of Columbus's cruelty and the depredations of the Spaniards against the Taino people who lived on the island in search of gold and other riches to take back to Spain were chronicled by Bartolomé de las Casas, who accompanied Columbus, and thus not a secret. Taken as the spoils of war after defeating Spain in 1898, Puerto Rico became one of several U.S. colonies over which the major decisions have been made by Washington and whose residents are less than equal to those of the United States, having no voting representatives in Congress nor the right to vote for president. In Puerto Rico, this was most exemplified by the use of the island of Vieques as an all-purpose U.S. Navy facility for everything from training to dropping tons of explosives from 1940 to 2003, contaminating the land and the offshore waters until protests both in Puerto Rico and the United States brought the Navy's deadly presence to an end. Now, Puerto Ricans are confronting a very different type of abuse from the mainland. Since June, faced with $70 billion in debt that they did not create, and with no assistance forthcoming from Washington, Puerto Ricanos have lost the right to have any say about their island's internal affairs. That's the result of a piece of legislation, the Puerto Rican Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, with the ironic acronym PROMESA, or PROMISE, that was approved by both houses of Congress and signed by President Obama. The legislation has effectively turned the immediate future of the island to a group of banking industry executives with nothing promised to the Puerto Rican people but an austerity program unmatched in this hemisphere. That's what I'll be exploring with journalist Dave Dayan at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, let's look at some other news, none of it good, I'm afraid. Let's start with the presidential election. Those who have been closely following the race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump would have been aware before last week that WikiLeaks' Julian Assange had promised an October surprise that would be damaging to Clinton's electoral chances. What Assange and the public weren't aware of, however, was that the Democrats had their own October surprise, which they would use to divert attention from Assange's release of embarrassing emails whenever he launched it, which they did, accomplishing a major political coup which no one seems to question. But it explains why WikiLeaks' release of what should have been embarrassing emails has been all but missing from the news. Received by Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta, they contain quotes from her speeches to Goldman Sachs and other major banks and Wall Street firms, and they were counted on the same day by the Democrats' release of the tape of Donald Trump, confirming what every sentient being already knew, that the Donald is an obnoxious, sexist pig. What their emails confirmed is what Bernie Sanders had been saying in the primaries about her close ties to Wall Street and his call that she release the text of the 225,000 of pop speeches Clinton had been making to Goldman Sachs and others which Sanders no longer believes to be relevant. What the Obama White House and the Clinton campaign, which at the moment are inseparable, chose to do was to turn the email leaks of Democratic Party internal correspondence into an attack on Russia for what they charge with Moscow's attempts to meddle in the U.S. presidential elections, ignoring the fact that the very first leaks exposed the fact that only tampering being done was by the Democratic National Committee to sink the Bernie Sanders campaign. That's called chutzpah. Although the contents of those emails were, without question, far more important than learning what the public already knew about Trump, the Clinton-friendly media took full advantage of the opportunity to all but bury the leaked email story, which was barely touched, and then to Clinton's advantage in Sunday night's debate. No media outlet was more culpable than NPR, which from Friday through Sunday devoted just over an hour to the Trump sex tape and less than a minute to the leaked emails. What were they covering up? Simply statements that Clinton made to Goldman Sachs and other banks and lobbying and investment firms that would put her in an awkward position if revealed. They were contained in an 80-page addendum sent to Clinton National Campaign Manager, former Chief of Staff for Bill Clinton, John Podesta, by Tony Carr, Research Director of Hillary for America. The one that did come up in the debate was a statement she made to the National Multi-Housing Council, a lobbying group for the apartment industry, in 2013, which she said, quote, "If everybody's watching, you know, all of the backroom discussions and the deals, you know, then people get a little nervous, say the least. So you need both a public and a private position," end quote. A revealing passage that fits the public conception that Clinton can't be trusted, which she tried to get around this by comparing her political travails with that of President Lincoln when trying to get the Congress to approve the 13th Amendment that freed the slaves. To a Goldman Sachs group in 2013, she said, quote, "The blame placed on the United States banking system for the crisis could have been avoided in terms of both misunderstanding and really politicizing what happened. You guys help us figure it out, and let's make sure we do it right this time," she told them. On the same note, speaking to the Deutsche Bank in 2014, Clinton looked to the financial industry to regulate itself, and incredibly citing Teddy Roosevelt as an example. "Yes, he took on what he saw as the excess in the economy," she told the bankers, "but he also stood against the excesses in politics. He didn't want to unleash a lot of nationalist populist reaction. Today, there's more that can and should be done that really has to come from the industry itself," end quote. And again, speaking to Goldman Sachs in 2013, she further cozied up to Wall Street, saying, "There's nothing magic about regulations. Too much is bad. Too little is bad. How do you get to the golden key? How do we figure out what works? And the people that know the industry better than anybody else are the people who work in the industry," end quote. In 2013, again, in another speech to Goldman Sachs, Clinton expressed her concern for those who, quote, "go to Washington to work in a government and have to divest their assets. You know," she said, "the divestment of assets, the stripping of all kinds of positions, the sale of stocks, it just becomes very onerous and unnecessary," end quote. Speaking to a meeting of Goldman and BlackRock 2 years ago, after describing the middle-class life in which she grew up, Clinton acknowledged that, quote, "obviously, I'm kind of far removed because the life I've lived and the economic, you know, fortunes that my husband and I now enjoy, but I haven't forgotten it," end quote. In other words, she feels our pain. Regarding trade, we know that while she was Secretary of State under Obama, Clinton declared the Trans-Pacific Partnership to be the gold standard of trade agreements, but while running for president, she has flip-flopped on the issue, now saying she opposes it. But who believes her? 3 years ago, speaking to the Banco d'Italia, Clinton said, quote, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders sometime in the future, with energy that is green and sustainable as we can get it, powering growth and opportunity for every person in the hemisphere," end quote. It certainly hasn't worked that way for workers in the countries that joined NAFTA, which Bill and she championed and arguably wasn't intended to. What comes across from her comments is that while choosing her words carefully, she wanted to make it clear that she is the friend of Wall Street. On Sunday, as we have come to expect, few serious issues were presented for the candidates to debate. Besides the ritual China bashing and the war in Syria, where the U.S. is seeing the result of its support for al-Qaeda-linked foreign jihadists mirror that of the Carter and Reagan administration and the Mujahideen they armed against the Russians in Afghanistan in 1979, which became al-Qaeda, key foreign policy issues continue to be ignored at these sham presidential debates. Ironically, on the issue of Syria, Trump came across as a realist and Clinton as a flaky warmonger, with the Donald accusing Clinton of not even knowing what groups compose the fighters that the U.S. supports, where her repeated calls to implement a no-fly zone threatened a major war with Russia. What we heard no mention of was America's longest war, that in Afghanistan, where the Taliban now controls more territory than at any time since the U.S. invasion, and the decision by the European Union to send thousands of Afghan refugees back home to an uncertain future. There were no questions about how the candidates would deal with the tumultuous events in Latin America or the decisions of the new Philippine president, Rodrigo Duterte, to seek close relations with China. Last week, Duterte, who will visit Beijing this month, announced that he would be restructuring his foreign policy, At some point, he said, I will break up with America. Duterte, who has received criticism from world leaders and human rights organizations, justly so, for his policy of killing drug addicts, has already said that he wants all U.S. troops out of the country. Last Tuesday, his foreign secretary, Perfecto Yase Jr., went further, posting online a statement explaining why the country needed a new foreign policy. Since the Philippines won independence from the U.S., its former colonial master, in 1946, he wrote, the United States held on to invisible chains that reined us in toward dependency and submission as little brown brothers not capable of true independence or freedom, end quote. That's actually been the attitude of Washington to most other countries around the globe whose governments are not dominated by people of European ancestry. It also helps to understand the U.S. attitude toward Israelis and Palestinians, even without taking into account that the former has a lobby of incomparable wealth and power supporting it, while the latter, in terms of effectiveness, has nothing. This discrepancy in power was in evidence this past month in several instances. First, President Obama authorized, in effect, a $38 billion debit card from which Israel can withdraw $3.8 billion annually for the next decade to buy U.S. weaponry, which we talked about on my last program. Rather than expressing appreciation for such an outlandish gift, a number of Israeli officials, as well as their lackeys in the Senate, believe it wasn't enough. This record appropriation was not even hinted at in either of the first two presidential debates. Why not? Well, second, when Shimon Peres, the last of Israel's founding fathers, gave up the ghost in 93, President Obama ordered the flags of all U.S. government buildings to be flown at half-staff for a month. He was the second Israeli leader to be so honored, Yitzhak Rabin being the first after his assassination in 1995. Two of the remaining six, Egypt's Anwar Sadat and Jordan's King Hussein, a longtime CIA asset, were both given the half-staff treatment, not for anything they did for the United States, but because they signed peace treaties with Israel. Think about that. The other four were Winston Churchill, former UN Secretary Dag Hammarskjöld, Pope John Paul II, and most recently Nelson Mandela. There are other actions in Peres' long life that should have kept him from having American flags lowered for a month, about one of which Lebanon-based British journalist Robert Fisk, the Dean of Middle East Correspondence, had much to say. In an article in The Independent in Britain titled, quote, The Butcher of Cana, Peres was no peacemaker, it was republished in Counterpunch website. Fisk wrote, quote, when the world heard that Shimon Peres had died, it shouted, peacemaker. But when I heard that Peres was dead, I thought of blood and fire and slaughter. I saw the results, babies torn apart, shrieking refugees, smoldering bodies. It was a place called Cana, and most of the 106 bodies in camp where they were torn to pieces by Israeli shells in 1996. I had been on a UN aid convoy just outside the South Lebanese village, recalled Fisk. Those shells switched right over our heads and into the refugee pack below us. It lasted for 17 minutes. Shimon Peres, standing for election as Israel's prime minister, a post he inherited when his predecessor Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, decided to increase his military credentials before polling day by assaulting Lebanon. The joint Nobel Peace Prize holder, wrote Fisk, used as an excuse the firing of Katyusha rockets over the Lebanese border by the Hezbollah. In fact, their rockets were retaliation for the killing of a small Lebanese boy by a booby-trap bomb they suspected had been left by an Israeli patrol. It mattered not. Peres announced that, quote, we did not know that several hundred people were concentrated in that camp. It came to us as a bitter surprise, end quote. It was a lie, wrote Fisk. The Israelis were even flying a drone over the camp during the 1996 massacre, a fact they denied until a UN soldier gave me his video of the drone, frames of which we published in The Independent, noted Fisk. The UN had repeatedly told Israel that the camp was packed with refugees. This is Peres' contribution to Lebanese peace. He lost the election and probably never thought much more about Cana. But I never forgot it, wrote Robert Fisk. I visited Cana a decade later and stood on the cement over where those children were buried. And I'm going to spare you the grisly details Fisk describes in the remainder of that article. But for those of you who are interested, it's up on the Counterpunch website. There is more in Paris' rap sheet that's worth noting and wasn't mentioned by our cowed president or our equally cowed media. Peres was the architect of Israel's nuclear weapons program and the politician behind Israel's illegal settlement program. No American president has dared to acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons because to do so would require termination of all aid to Israel on the basis of U.S. law that prohibits giving money to any non-signer of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, like Israel, found to have nuclear weapons or components. Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy filed a suit in federal court in August based on that law, which would halt Obama's $38 billion gift to Israel if applied. But as we have learned over the years, Israel is above the law, and its U.S. friends have sufficient control over our media to make sure that doesn't get reported, right? You haven't seen it. And if you didn't hear it here, you haven't heard about it. Perhaps the most obscene part of the end of the Paris story was noted by Paul de Rouge, a Dutch journalist based in London, in his counterpunch essay, Never Let a Corpse Go to Waste. Comparing the dead Israeli to a mafia boss, de Rouge wrote, quote, what's worth exploring is a funeral spectacle staged at Mount Herzl. The state funeral enabled the current Israeli regime to festoon the area with Israeli flags to posture and show off its power. Never mind the daily killings, the arbitrary imprisonment of hundreds of Palestinians, and the continuing siege of Gaza, the world's largest open-air prison. Here come dozens of Western dignitaries to be seen paying homage, de Rouge wrote. The attendees jostled to outdo one another on this farcical show. De Rouge noted that from the U.S., quote, in attendance were the president, a former president, the secretary of state, the current and former national security advisors, a senator, 18 congressmen, assorted high government officials, former government officials, and a long list of sidekicks and wannabes. The list wasn't longer because Air Force One and Two couldn't fit all those clamoring to clamor on board. Obama arrived hours after having showed off his executive vigor by ordering all U.S. flags to fly at half-mast in honor of Paris. Well, that was from Paul de Rouge. You'll find that on Counterpunch. When Obama returned to Washington, he got his reward. An announcement by Israel of yet a new Jewish-only settlement to be built on the West Bank that Netanyahu hadn't told him about when the two met in New York at the U.N. The administration responded to that latest poke in the eye by our Israeli friends, as it had to similar announcements in the past, by expressing its extreme displeasure and doing nothing. Finally, an effort by a group of international women peace activists, including a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ireland's Meret Maguire, and former U.S. Army Colonel Anne Wright, to sail to Gaza, was interrupted by the Israeli Navy, which seized their boat in international waters and took the women as prisoners to Israel. That's an act of piracy in the high seas, dear listeners. But when Israel does it, the world looks the other way. And this is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jennifer Clark of the Brennan Center for Justice, who provides an update on legal challenges to voter suppression laws across the U.S., and concern about Donald Trump's call for election observers to root out alleged voter fraud at the polls. Journalist Shane Burley, who discusses how alt-right white supremacist groups are attempting to organize a base of support on American college campuses. And Chris Schweitzer of New Haven, Connecticut's Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge, who explains why his group displayed 24 inflatable aliens on a city street to promote dialogue on the issue of climate change. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Growing skirmishes between Islamic militants and India's army in the disputed territory of Kashmir has fueled fears of a new war between India and Pakistan. In late September, India conducted a well-publicized raid, crossing the line of control into Pakistan to destroy militant camps. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has come under intense pressure from Hindu nationalists to retaliate against a militant raid that killed 19 Indian soldiers at a Kashmir military base. As hostility worsens, one of the casualties may be the binational Indus Waters Treaty, where India and Pakistan have jointly managed water resources vital to South Asia. The water treaty, which dates back to 1960, has survived numerous conflicts between the two nations. On September 22nd, India threatened to revoke the Indus Treaty. Pakistan's foreign minister, Sartaj Aziz, called any move to revoke the treaty an act of war. Pakistan currently gets 80% of its water from three rivers managed under the treaty, which flow mostly into irrigating crops. Pakistan threatened to bring the issue before the United Nations and the International Court of Justice. The $40 billion hedge fund, Akzif Capital Management, has agreed to pay over $400 million in fines for bribing numerous officials in Africa in order to gain access to natural resources. In a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the hedge fund signed a deferred prosecution agreement related to its actions in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Libya, Chad, and Niger. The federal corruption probe focused on the activities of Michael Cohen, the hedge fund's former head of European investing, who oversaw investments in Africa. Working with an Israeli businessman, Cohen bribed Congolese officials to win natural resource deals. According to Reuters, the Israeli associate paid over $100 million in bribes to officials in the Congo between 2005 and 2012. In a move related to the Africa bribery investigation, a Gabonese national, Samuel Mebiame, was recently charged with conspiring to bribe foreign government officials to obtain mining rights in Chad, Niger, and Guinea. He allegedly worked as a fixer in a venture co-owned by Akzif. Years before the U.S. opioid addiction crisis exploded, a small group called the Pain Crisis Forum, dominated by pharmaceutical drug companies, warned Congress about an impending crisis of chronic pain afflicting 100 million Americans. Yet a letter to U.S. senators on the looming pain crisis completely ignored the rising number of deaths from overdoses of prescription drugs like OxyContin, Vicodin, and Percocet. The Pain Forum and its pro-industry allies had considerable influence inside the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in crafting a proposal to battle the crisis of opioid addiction. According to an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity and the Associated Press, the Pain Crisis Forum, a network of drug companies, trade groups, and pro-industry nonprofits, spent $740 million funding lobbyists on Capitol Hill and dozens of state capitals between 2006 and 2015. The same drug industry groups donated $140 million to candidates running for state and federal office. In contrast, groups promoting new restrictions on painkiller drugs raised only $4 million for lobbyists and political donations. Congress recently passed election year legislation that improves access to treatment for opioid addiction, but it imposes no restrictions on the distribution of painkillers or mandates any training for prescribing doctors. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After the Republican Party won a number of key elections for governorships and control of state legislatures across the U.S. in 2010, 21 states passed an assortment of new laws that make it more difficult for specific groups of citizens to vote. These measures include restrictive voter ID laws, reduction in the days and hours of early voting, obstacles placed on registering new voters, and accessing absentee ballots. These voter suppression laws were made possible in large part by the Supreme Court's 2013 ruling that gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. With the threat that a large number of voters, especially minorities and young people, could lose their right to vote as a result of these measures in the 2016 presidential election, legal challenges were mounted to overturn these laws in federal court. By late July, some legal efforts succeeded in overturning or modifying several voter suppression laws in North Carolina, Wisconsin, Kansas, Texas, Ohio, and Michigan. While restrictions on voting rights remain in some states, these victories were substantial. However, there's growing concern that GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump's charge that the November election will be rigged and his call to supporters to become election observers to challenge alleged fraud at the polls could result in attempts to intimidate certain groups of voters when they show up to cast their ballot. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Clark, a counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses the status of efforts to overturn voter suppression laws and the potential damage from organized voter intimidation tactics at the polls on November 8th.
So we've seen a ton of lawsuits, and many of them successful, actually, over the summer and into the fall, that have really pushed back against a wave of restrictive voting laws. I think some of the most high-profile ones have been pushback against strict photo ID laws that require voters to show one of a very small number of IDs to vote. We've seen a court in Texas, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals actually say that Texas had to make changes to its ID law because it was discriminatory against African American and Latino voters there. We saw a federal court in North Dakota say something similar about that state's strict law, which actually disenfranchised the Native Americans there who were less likely to have access to photo IDs. We've seen a lawsuit in Wisconsin that's been going kind of back and forth and back and forth over both voter ID and some early voting restrictions, and we actually got a decision that created more early voting opportunities for voters there, finding that the law had been passed with the intent to make it harder for African Americans there to vote because African Americans disproportionately in Wisconsin tend to use early voting opportunities. We've also seen a monster of a lawsuit in North Carolina because North Carolina passed an omnibus restrictive voting law in the wake of the Shelby County decision that kind of hobbled the Voting Rights Act and made it much easier for states to pass these kinds of discriminatory laws. And they passed a law that really hit all the notes of making it harder to vote. And there was a decision in the summer from Federal Court of Appeals there saying that North Carolina's law was passed, again, with the intent to make it harder for African Americans there to vote. And they actually wiped the entire law off the books. So we've seen a lot of litigation around these issues, and a lot of it is going in a good direction for voters.
Jennifer, Donald Trump says that if he loses the election, it'll be proof that the election was rigged around the country. He's also made a call out to his supporters to become citizen poll observers, which seems some coded language to try to intimidate voters of color, possibly Muslims, and certainly young people might be targeted by those supporters if they do show up at the polls. What are some of your concerns at the Brennan Center about this call for, quote-unquote, ballot security?
So it is very concerning to hear a call for, voters to go and kind of police other voters at the polls. That has a very problematic history in our country that goes back to Jim Crow and earlier, where we have seen a lot of very, zealous policing at the polls that actually, at the end of the day, results in intimidation for voters and creates a very intimidating circumstance. You know, people who might have good intentions going down to the polls, there's clearly been a lot of feelings and, you know, emotions are running very high around this election in particular, and things very quickly have a chance to, you know, spiral and to cross the line from watching into intimidation. And so we're very concerned about that. We think that's a real problem. And we have, on our website, have been putting out a lot of information about what's actually legal and what crosses the line into intimidation. And I would strongly encourage people to try to, make sure that they watch out at their polling place, make sure that no one is around to intimidate them or, you know, showing up and walking around in police or military garb. And I would encourage folks to call election protection hotlines if they see that kind of behavior going on at their polls.
Summarize for our audience a bit about what the Brennan Center's thinking is in some long-term remedies and reforms that will prevent these kind of blatant attempts to prevent certain groups of people from casting ballots. It seems like we're going backwards in so many ways. I know one of the things that the Brennan Center is advocating is rapid restoration of the Voting Rights Act. But maybe you could expand on that briefly for us.
Of course. In 2013, the Supreme Court really hobbled the Voting Rights Act by striking down a part of it that required states that had a history of discrimination in voting at the polls to pre-clear some changes. And that law worked very well. And we have seen since it has been struck down that there has been a wave of restrictive voting laws that have come into place. So this idea that it wasn't working anymore, it wasn't doing the job it was supposed to, which, you know, seemed to be the Supreme Court's reasoning and its opinion and Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, you know, that's been proven false. And so if you look, for example, at the overlay between states that have passed restrictive laws and states that were previously required to pre-clear their laws under this part of the Voting Rights Act that was struck down, it's a pretty high percentage. It's a pretty good match. So it was obviously doing its work. And the Brennan Center and others in the voting rights field are working very hard with Congress and with bipartisan support in Congress to try to get the Voting Rights Act restored, to update the coverage formula so that the states that have a recent history of discrimination in voting would have to pre-clear their laws again. And so we could prevent years of litigation, which is really what we've had to go through to get to this point, to reach those victories I was talking about. We could prevent the years of litigation and the loss of votes throughout the course of the litigation if really states had to make sure that things were okay before they put them into place.
That was Jennifer Clark, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program. Learn more about challenges to voter suppression laws and methods to counter organized voter intimidation tactics by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump appointed Stephen Bannon as his new campaign CEO on August 17th, many questions were asked about Bannon's links with white supremacist, misogynist, and anti-Semitic bloggers and groups who had found a safe haven on the popular right-wing Breitbart website where he served as chairman. Bannon and others on the alternative right or alt-right movement have no consistent or officially recognized ideology, although commonly held views include opposition to multiculturalism, immigration, and feminism, as well as an affinity for white nationalism, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and nativism. Democratic Party presidential nominee Hillary Clinton responded to Bannon's appointment to lead the Trump campaign with a speech in Reno, Nevada in late August devoted to denouncing Trump's divisive rhetoric, appealing to the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right. In that speech, Clinton warned that a nationalist conservative fringe had taken over the Republican Party. Stephen Bannon's rise to lead a major party presidential campaign and the alt-right support for Donald Trump has apparently emboldened and reinvigorated the right-wing movement. Now there are reports that prominent figures and lesser-known groups linked with the alt-right are attempting to cultivate interest and recruit new members on college and university campuses across the U.S. Your reporter spoke with journalist Shane Burley, who discusses his investigation into the activities of the alt-right in academia, featured in the recent article, How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses, co-written with Alexander Reed Ross.
It was a new strategy for them. What they were trying to do was get under the radar of local anti-racist and anti-fascist organizations and then be able to hold an event that essentially kind of looks good to the media, it looks good to passing students, and it looks good to their own media really well. And so what they did was they only announced it about 48 hours in advance. And so this is a few groups, some of which we know and some of which we don't. The National Policy Institute's been around for a number of years. It's kind of taken the lead in terms of this new buzz around the alt-right. So they recently put on a large press conference in Washington. They've been leading the large conferences. Richard Spencer, who's the director of it, has been kind of out in front fielding, you know, interviews with reporters and things like that. And he's been kind of the person that he's the person that coined the term alt-right, and he's kind of been maybe like an ideological forefather for it. But then this other group, Identity Europa, is really kind of the, was doing the groundwork at Berkeley, and they have been, not just in California, but in Portland, Oregon, in the Midwest. There's been, I think, the posters on the East Coast, trying to create kind of a nationalist student group, a fraternal organization, as they like to call it, that's going to be on college campuses and appeal to young people, and to try and do what a lot of leftist groups do on campus, which is to create kind of a campus culture.
Shane, what's been the reception on college campuses like Berkeley and the other universities and colleges that they've tried to organize rallies and recruit members?
It's been mixed. It hasn't been great, generally. They're not getting warm welcomes. Milo Yiannopoulos, who's well-known for writing at Breitbart, he's what you call an alt-light. He's more kind of a diet alt-right. He kind of mainstreamed their opinions without maybe having a lot of the baggage. He's getting challenged at a lot of his university speaking events, but they are sold out nonetheless. People like Richard Spencer, they're not well-known by administration. A lot of the student groups that would challenge him don't really know the baggage he brings in. You know, he's not waving a swastika. He's not coming in a clown robe. So it's not quite as obvious. And so there hasn't been a large-scale student movement against it. When it's made obvious, it's pretty roundly rejected. What's gone over a little bit better is alt-right students going into Students for Trump organizations. And that's something we've seen on a lot of college campuses. In Portland, Oregon, at Portland State University, Portland State Students for Trump was alleged to be harassing multiracial student organizers, really kind of making a nasty culture on campus. And that's run by, you know, alt-right ideologues, young people that are on these alt-right message boards that are kind of creating a community amongst those. So that's been kind of their entry to get a little bit more high profile. With groups like Identity Europa, it's really too new to tell. Anti-fascist organizations off campus have been responding really strongly to them, but it's yet to see if they're going to have much of a pull on campus.
Shane, are these groups at all associated with violence, whether directed at particular students or student organizations anywhere around the country?
I think the answer is yes and no. Their entire existence, the entire way they function, their talking points, their messaging, their branding, all of it is based around the idea of taking their white nationalist message and stripping away the connotation of violence. The problem is that white nationalism is a history of violence. It's completely inseparable. So you take Nathan Domingo, who founded Identity Europa, and he will strip all forms of racial slurs and violent language out of his discourse. But of course, you know, he served over 5 years in prison for violently attacking a Muslim man. American Renaissance is a really great example. You know, yeah, they will talk about, you know, peaceful politics, this and that, but if you look at the crowd, you're going to have skinheads, you're going to have neo-Nazi party members, you're going to have Klansmen. And the same is true of League of the South, Council of Conservative Citizens, all these groups that have a kind of close, tight network and kind of make up a lot of the core of the alt-right. And then at the same time, do you have groups that have been associated with the alt-right that are actively recruiting from that kind of more violent undercurrent? So the Traditionalist Youth Network, which you mentioned in the article, they recently held an event in Sacramento, and they decided to invite Golden State skinheads and Sacktown skins, two skinhead gangs, and ended up stabbing seven counter-protesters. I think eight or nine people ended up in the hospital. So this is something that happens relatively regularly when you have this long history of this kind of violent confrontation. And it's really hard for the alt-right to completely reject it because it's something that's really baked into their ideological legacy.
That was journalist Shane Burley, co-author along with Alexander Reed Ross of the article titled How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses, published on the Waging Nonviolence website. Find a link to the article and learn more about the alt-right movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Widely respected climate scientist James Hansen and other experts have long insisted that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere cannot remain above 350 parts per million if we hope to maintain any semblance of life on Earth as we've known it. That warning was underscored when the level of carbon dioxide surpassed 400 parts per million for the entire month of September 2016. In fact, every month for the past three decades has seen hotter than average temperatures. A new paper published by Dr. Hansen and his colleagues declared that reducing the amount of heat-warming gases like CO2 and methane released in the future will not ensure our survival. The scientists maintain that governments working together must devise new methods to remove massive amounts of existing global warming gases from the atmosphere, which is an extremely difficult challenge. This challenge is made more difficult, especially in the U.S., by the propaganda churned out by the fossil fuel industry and allied politicians that has been a major obstacle blocking congressional action while the severity of climate change grows more dire. One group in New Haven, Connecticut, has initiated a new effort called Let's Talk About Climate Change as a strategy to challenge congressional gridlock. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with New Haven's Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge organizer Chris Schweitzer at a downtown New Haven intersection where his group set up a display of more than two dozen colorful inflatable plastic aliens. Here, Schweitzer explains the message being sent with this offbeat art installation.
So we're using the aliens to get people to think about how, through climate change, humans are creating an alien planet, a planet that has different climate and weather systems than what we've known for all of human history. And we're particularly inviting people to start talking more about climate change. We're organizing a Let's Talk About Climate Change events and inviting other folks to likewise have informal or formal discussions and just get people talking about climate change.
And how would that work? Do you have experts come or is it just a group of people?
So on our website, this is being organized by Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge. And on that website, we have a lot of great resources, videos, discussion guides, graphics. And it could be as informal as you want. Have people over your house have a discussion, put a sticker on, you know, sign up in your office. Just get people talking about climate change. Because we started this because different surveys have shown that even though people are concerned about climate change and aware of it, they feel like it's too hot a subject to talk about it, and that other people don't want to talk about it. But surveys say most people do want to talk about it. So we're trying to, through posters and stickers and discussions and this kind of event, invite people to talk about it more.
You've got these signs and it says, all those scary movies about aliens destroying your world, and you're doing it to yourselves.
Right. So we have a lot of kind of wise-ass signs that different people made up about, you know, aliens coming and saying, this is our planet B, where's your planet B, kind of thing. And just part of the kind of idea to get people thinking about what we're doing, kind of fun, whimsical way.
So while I was waiting for you, there were five guys, workmen, having their lunch break, just sitting on the steps where we're sitting right now. And I went over to them with a sticker and asked, you know, if anybody wanted to talk about climate change. And one guy very vocally said, no, thank you. One of them did take the sticker. And we ended up having this fascinating conversation about insulation and different kinds of insulation and how this one kind is really the best. It's also the most expensive. And then I said, but if you live in your house long enough, over time, you'd not only recoup that, you'd start saving money on it, right? And he said, yeah, that was sure. And then one of the other guys said, we carpool. That's our contribution. And I said, hey, you know, that's great. That works. So, I mean, it was sort of this whole let's talk about climate change microcosm of, you know, four or five people just sitting
right,
here.
Right.
And some, you know, just actively refusing to engage. And, you know, it's an interesting question about, you know, what do they think people are telling them they're going to need to do? How much are they going to have to suffer versus how much, if they don't do anything, they're going to have to suffer down the line? So are there any particular approaches or factoids that you think are particularly good to engage in this conversation?
Well, we really think that policy change is really important for the state, particularly to really, you know, try to cut back on fossil fuels, cut back on natural gas use, and, you know, support policies that encourage people to weatherize their homes, support policies that encourage solar and community-based solar. Because that's where you really get the most impact, is changing the systems away from fossil fuel-based energy systems and transportation systems to ones that use clean energy, wind, solar, and other forms of energy. But for individuals who just care right now, you can look at your own, you know, greenhouse gas, your footprint, and make some choices, because most choices, in our estimation, that are good for your own health and good for community health also cut greenhouse gases. Biking more, walking, taking the bus once in a while, carpooling, you know, weatherizing your house, eating more local food. These are all good things for your health, for the environment locally, and for cutting greenhouse gases.
And some of them certainly would also save the person money.
Yep.
That was Chris Schweitzer, an organizer with New Haven's Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge, and program director with the New Haven León, Nicaragua Sister City Project. For more information and resources on the need to expand public discussion on climate change, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu Jabal's radio essay.
The politics of challenge, equal sign. The politics of change. The most consequential political presidential season of modern American history is afoot, and within days, the direction of the empire will be set into electoral stone. The choices presented to the voting populace is one that could hardly be less appetizing. The spoiled billionaire brat, Donald J. Trump, versus Her Highness Hillary Rodham, although she doesn't use her maiden name these days, Clinton. And the race is, in a numerical sense, inches apart. That this is so, that an outrageous political novice could be within striking distance of Clinton, a political figure in her own right as former First Lady, wife, partner of past President William Jefferson Clinton, Secretary of State under President Barack Obama, and former U.S. Senator from New York, is a rather telling tale of her political woes and weaknesses. Imagine where Bernie Sanders would be head-to-head against Trump. It is also a sobering reflection of how rejectionist is the U.S. electorate and how hungry they are for change, any change. Bernie, anyone? And yet, the die is cast. The clock ticks away, and the fate of the empire is likely to be determined by the swing votes, not of any state particularly, but by the voting choices determined by the black vote, that nebulous, numerous variable that can set the scene of this political tragicomedy. With that kind of power, that strategic leverage, what are blacks demanding? What promises have they exacted from either major political choice? The answer is as sad as it is almost inevitable. Nothing. So beaten, so battered, so desperate are black lives in this aging empire, so hungry are they for simple recognition that millions will vote, and mostly for Hillary, in hope, with promises of nothing. Nothing. How can we be surprised when that is precisely what we will get? Power, said the great Frederick Douglass, concedes nothing without demand. What have black politicians, black preachers, black feminists demanded? A repeal of AEDPA, AEDPA, the law that suspended and truncated habeas corpus? A 50% reduction of mass incarceration? An end to the police industrial complex? What? The only voices that emerged from the black and youth community that dared criticize Her Highness and the political poison personified by her husband, President Clinton, has been Black Lives Matter. But among the insiders, the politicians, nothing. So black Americans, who have the most to lose among all Americans, hang on to hope and little else. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Young college students gathered together in an office in Oakland, California, mid-October 1966. No one, not even themselves, knew what they could or would accomplish. The men, 24-year-old Huey P. Newton and 29-year-old Bobby G. Seale, would leave the office with something called the 10-Point Program, and through the organization they founded, the Black Panther Party, they would impact the nation and enter the annals of history. The party had global impacts and marked a generation with its paw print of black youth and class resistance. But as we know, that was 50 years ago, a lifetime ago. Who knew that any of us would still be alive today? Today, decades later, some of us are still dwelling in the system's prison cells, political prisoners in everything but name. Let us not forget our brothers and fellow warriors in chains, among them Sundiata Okoli, a comrade of freed political prisoner Assata Shakur and the late Zaid Malik Shakur, captured May 2, 1973. He is a prolific writer. Delbert Orr Africa, a member of the Chicago chapter, now a member of the MOVE organization and one of the MOVE Nine, members of MOVE imprisoned after a confrontation with cops in Philadelphia, August 8, 1978. Russell Maroon Schultz, a member of the Black Unity Council, an affiliate of the Philadelphia branch, also a brilliant writer, historian, and thinker. Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly known as Rap Brown, was the former Minister of Justice of the Black Panther Party. He was an anti-drug activist in Atlanta, where he led as Imam of the local mosque. Joseph Jojo Bowen of the Philadelphia branch. Robert Seth Hayes of the New York chapter, presently facing serious health challenges, including diabetes and hepatitis C conditions. Fred Muhammad Burton, Philadelphia branch, now doing time at SCI Somerset. Dr. Mutulu Shakur, an acupuncturist by trade, who was convicted of helping Asada get free. He's also the loving stepfather of the late legendary rapper Tupac Shakur. Jaleel Montekin of the New York chapter, who with the late revolutionary leader Safia Bukhari co-founded the Jericho Movement in 1998 to help educate people on political prisoners and advocate for their freedom. These are some of the many people who have done decades in prison for political revolutionary activities during the 60s, 70s, and 1980s. Most have been members of the Black Panther Party or the Black Liberation Army and were freedom fighters for the black nation. Let us not forget them. Let us organize for their freedom and the freedom of us all. For more information, contact thejerichomovement.com. It's been 50 unbelievable years since Huey and Bobby typed out the 10-point program and platform of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. How many times in the last 50 years have you reread the 10-point program and marveled at how grim the conditions still facing millions of black people remain? Half a century, and black life still don't matter. Let us join with our younger brothers and sisters and help build a freedom movement worthy of our fallen soldiers and our ancestors. From imprisoned nation, this is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Presidential campaign has exploded. Videotapes of Donald J. Trump glorying in his sexual conquests or attempts have caused a hemorrhaging of support, especially among women who are shocked and sickened by his sheer grossness when he speaks about women being grabbed in their privates by him. Many Republicans who are thoughtful, sensitive, and honest are repulsed by the man. But as the old saying goes, you get what you pay for, or maybe I should say, what Trump paid for. This, then, is the face and voice of the Trump Party, branded by a man who loathes everything but money. The political scientist Andrew Hacker, author of Two Nations, Black and White, Separate, Hostile, Unequal, predicted that the Republican Party would morph into the White Party, which neither wanted nor needed the black vote. Under Trump, it no longer needs Latino votes. 2 million Muslim Americans need not apply either, it seems. And because of the nation's demographic changes, the GOP is left with creating barriers to voting and blocking black and Latino voters from the ballot box by hook or by crook. For generations, these were the tactics of the Democratic Party, enforced by the white terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan. Now the Klan is on board with the Trump Party. The Republican Party is on fire. But this isn't a case of arson. Donald J. Trump lit the match, and like a silly child, he is clapping with glee as it burns to the ground.
What is hybrid warfare, and what distinguishes it from other forms of geostrategy? What exactly is the U.S. trying to accomplish in Syria and Ukraine, the most recent test cases for hybrid warfare? How are ethnicity, religion, and other social factors being utilized to further strategic aims? What regions of the world are likely to be the next sites of hybrid warfare? What role do massive refugee flows play in furthering or frustrating the U.S. imperial agenda? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at a unique new form of military strategy which has come to the fore in the Obama era at a time when military tensions between the U.S. and Russia continue to grow. It's called hybrid warfare, and our guest for the entire hour is an American commentator based in Moscow who authored a 2015 book on the subject. On this week's program, Hybrid Warfare and U.S. Geostrategy, a conversation with Andrew Korbko. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 14th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The CETA agreement is a backdoor initiative which was developed in close coordination with the TTIP. Its adoption would trigger the de facto, rather than de jure, adoption of the broader TTIP agreement, leading to the eventual integration of the trading structures of the North American Union and the European Union. It would create a fait accompli, which would contribute to furthering the TTIP negotiations, most probably under a different label. It is a corporate takeover in both the EU and North America. It will serve to destroy and undermine the economy at the local level, destroy the family farm, precipitate small and medium-sized enterprises into bankruptcy, undermine social programs, etc. It is important that people in the U.S., Canada, and the European Union across the land firmly oppose the signing and ratification of the Canada and European Union, EU, Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA. That comes from the article, Towards NAFTA-EU Economic Integration, Backdoor Canada-EU Trade Agreement, CETA, Sets the Stage, by Michelle Chosadovsky, reposted October 13th. The former governor of the Bank of England, Lord King, sees a post-Brexit environment in terms of a wonderland of prospects, again ones which feature the exploits of a lower pound economy suitably placed to wage economic assault. Naturally, many of these assumptions, the May Brigade is the only one in full employment in Britain these days, is based on the UK getting bullish in its supply of products, a point that gets increasingly complicated in the event of being prized out of chains in the European Union. Those priding British sovereignty have simply assumed that Britons will be cleverer and more resilient in that regard they will find magical markets unhindered by the sluggishness of the Eurozone. Again, the battle between marketplace, with the mammon of prosperity paraded before Britain, and the virtues of reforming a system that is not only creaking, but in some cases collapsing, continues to play out. That comes from the article Brexit and the Despotism of the British Pound Sterling by Dr. Benoit Campmark, posted October 12th. In one of the noblest speeches ever delivered at the United Nations during this century, Venezuelan Ambassador Ramirez, in words of brilliance, exposed the enormity of hypocrisy for which the ambassadors demonizing Russia are guilty, listing the colonialist aggressions and current war crimes throughout the Middle East and throughout the world for which the UK and the US have never been held to account. Ambassador Ramirez demonstrated that the Russian veto prevented the UN Security Council from endorsing the obliteration of Syria in the same Machiavellian way in which UN Security Council Resolution 678 on Iraq and 1973 on Libya unleashed the pulverizing bombing campaigns which turned the previously functioning and progressive governments of Iraq and Libya into current failed states incubating and rampantly spreading terrorism. The virulent beating of the war drums at the UN Security Council suggests a proxy war against Russia and predictions of Islamic terrorist attacks against Russian cities raise the terrifying prospect of another stealthy campaign to destabilize Russia, turning that sovereign country into a docile pawn of Western oligarchic interests. It would be prudent to recall that Russia is a nuclear power, and hubris doomed Napoleon and Hitler. Unfortunately, this time, hubris may also doom all humanity. That comes from the article Beating the Drums of War at the UN Security Council. Russia vetoes resolution to implement Syria no-fly zone by Carla Stay, posted October 12th. The text of S-2040 refers broadly to sponsors of terrorism. Potentially, it constitutes a legal mechanism as well as a foreign policy instrument which could be used against countries on Washington's hate list, including Russia, China, Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, etc. Conversely, it could also be used by U.S. citizens to sue some of America's staunchest allies on terrorism charges, including Israel, UK, France, Turkey, as well as Saudi Arabia. Another issue which the media seems to have carefully neglected is that the legislation is not limited to state entities and foreign governments. The bill allows U.S. citizens to sue both foreign governments as well as foreign organizations, loosely defined, allegedly involved in acts of terrorism on U.S. soil. That comes from the article Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, JASTA. U.S. citizens can now sue foreign governments, by Professor Michel Chostadovsky, posted October 13th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Political observers around the world are familiar with the concept of America's aggressive military tendencies going back decades. Methods of overthrowing inconvenient governments and frustrating whole nations and regions desiring to pursue an independent course has taken on a more sophisticated form, particularly during the presidency of Barack Obama. There's virtually no exposure of this phenomenon in the mainstream media. Indeed, media has been a significant component of this new form of imperialism. We're talking about hybrid warfare, and joining us to discuss the concept and take us through the examples that are manifesting themselves today, we're joined by Andrew Korybko. Andrew Korybko is an American political commentator currently working with the Sputnik news agency. He's also written for Oriental Review and Katahan, among other online journals. Much of his work focuses on the tactics of regime change, color revolutions, and unconventional warfare used across the world. His book, Hybrid Wars, The Indirect Adaptive Approach to Regime Change, extensively and analyzes the situations in Syria and Ukraine and claims to prove that they represent a new model of strategic warfare being waged by the United States. Andrew Kurybko currently studies at the Moscow State University of International Relations and is a member of the Expert Council for the Institute of Strategic Studies and Predictions at the People's Friendship University of Russia. Andrew Kurybko, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
What exactly differentiates hybrid warfare from the other sorts of covert CIA operations that we've heard about in the past?
Okay, the way that I see it is we need to look at hybrid war as it is the epitome of all that came before it, in the sense that right now we're living in a very rapidly accelerating globalized world. Everything is moving so fast, particularly as it relates to information and the transfer of people, goods, services, whatnot. Okay, everything's moving so fast. In this type of environment where all borders are permeable to a certain extent or another, if not physically, then definitely informationally and through some other types of asymmetric measures, we see that those methods of the past, primarily CIA-driven coups, be they military coups, be they people power revolution, like a color revolution, so to speak, or even just be it a terrorist war, we see that they're kind of coming together and things are moving so fast where we see a very interesting interplay where, you know, I've identified this pattern, Michael, where it seems as though, to me, the way I look at hybrid warfare, I see it as beginning with a color revolution that is meant to achieve a couple things. It could either be to enact a regime tweaking, which I define as getting political concessions from the targeted government, regime change, which we're all familiar with, and regime reboot, which in this case means to fundamentally rewrite the rules of the game. In some cases, change the constitution, federalize the unitary state, what have you. Now, when that color revolution fails or doesn't result in the expected dividend, it happens to almost organically transition into an unconventional war or a terrorist war, like we saw in Syria. The failed Arab Spring color revolution gave way to Daesh and terrorists over the place. And I see that, you know, if we look at these transnational connective infrastructure projects, like when you quoted my law of hybrid warfare, we can actually start to map areas that can actually be vulnerable to manufactured identity conflict. Most of these conflicts are already present. There already are some indicators, some tensions. Some of these things are naturally occurring to an extent. But the U.S. promotes the conditions for conflict amongst these different identities, using NGOs, using information warfare, using a variety of things, sometimes even scenarios, like in the case of Syria, which is the epitome example of what's happening nowadays. Even NGOs that turn into terrorists, like the White Helmets. I mean, Vanessa Bealey has done amazing work on that. So has Ava and Patrick Henningsen. They've done great work on that. But this is how I look at it, basically, Mark. Everything kind of coming together, intermingling according to this broad pattern that I've identified, and just adapting to the local circumstances, the local conflict problems and scenarios that we have there, and just kind of, you know, it's almost like a self-perpetuating process. Someone had once called it auto-synchronization. I thought that was a very accurate way to put it. And that's what we have here. That's what we have here. That's why it's different than other forms of coups and things, because this is pre-planned. This usually involves a large network of foreign state-based conspirators, be it in Ukraine. You had Putin in Syria. I mean, we know all the countries involved, the United States, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. We can't forget this entity that people call Israel. It's also very heavily involved.
25 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was, that one pole of this bipolar world. And so we've seen a lot of actions since then, which seem to be concerned with preventing the reestablishment of an alternative to the U.S. Dominant superpower. We're living in effectively a unipolar world, and so much of this where the hybrid war phenomenon somehow intersects with this reality of a dominant superpower trying to maintain its dominance. I mean, that has that not added to a specific feature or flavor to this strategy?
100%. That sets the whole background of strategic context for hybrid warfare. And actually, it's pretty funny that you brought this up, Michael, because this is exactly what I was writing about today when I was doing some work on my PhD. I was actually looking at 1990s American foreign policy and how this kind of paved the way for what we have today with regime change technology. So to answer the question, in 1992, Paul Wolfowitz, then Secretary of Defense, came out with what is known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine. This was a huge game changer. This came out around, I believe, around the beginning of 1992 or so. It was important because it was the first main defense promulgation that came out after the end of bipolarity, basically in the opening days of the unipolar world. And it was very clear in saying that the United States' objective is to make sure that no rival, any region, can ever rear their head where the U.S. will preemptively act to stop them. Now, in practice, what that means is to prevent the strategic convergence of Russia, China, and Iran. However, what we see, though, is we see that with this Wolfowitz Doctrine, one of the other, if we're going to talk about a theoretical aspect behind it, is this idea of perpetuating the hegemonic stability theory, which is an idea in international relations literature that says that the only way to have peace across the world is to have one country rule over the rest. Very, very imperial. It is the epitome of postmodern imperialism. But this is what the neoconservative faction of the American elite believes. Now, when I talk about neoconservatives for a moment, I refer to them as being an ideological faction of the deep state. By deep state, I define this as the permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies that ensure policy continuity amidst, you know, regular regime change in the U.S. By this, I mean elections. Theoretically, though, it's a regime change, right? Now, how this relates to what we have today with hybrid war and everything that happened in the 1990s, early 2000s, Bush, and continuing on towards with Obama is, to prevent the convergence of Russia, China, and Iran, the idea was to kind of marry the Wolfowitz Doctrine with Zbigniew Brzezinski's Eurasian Balkan Theorem, which very simply says that, hey, in the global transcontinental pivot space, so the so-called greater Mideast, including what we identify as the Mideast, North Africa, Horn of Africa, Central Asia, Caucasus, and even up to the Balkans, by the actual Balkans by some definition, this area is right in the middle of the tricontinental pivot space. However, it has many, many diverse identities. It has a history of internal discord, a lot of this influence from abroad. The idea that Brzezinski had, based off of his research in the 1970s before he created the Mujahideen with Jimmy Carter, was to use the Islamic factor and to use kind of this clash of civilizations idea to just splinter the whole thing up, basically divide it all up, and through this chaos, this creative chaos, if you will, that will create enough problems to keep Eurasia divided. Now, what's interesting is actually talks about, you know, dividing this up and everything in the clash of civilizations. He doesn't talk about that. But at the same time, that's where Samuel Huntington came out with his idea. Why this is so important, Michael, is many people took the clash of civilizations to be a warning. The way I see it, it wasn't a warning. It was a blueprint for how the U.S. would implement the Eurasian Balkans and the Wolfowitz Doctrine in dividing and ruling the entire Eastern Hemisphere. We see that George Bush, with the invasion of Iraq, the war on Iraq in 2003, and Afghanistan in 2001, these two states were already predetermined targets. I mean, there is existing publicly available literature from Project for a New American Century and other neoconservative outlets that pinpoint these countries as targets because of what they geostrategically represent. Yes, there was energy as a factor. On the other hand, there was also the idea of an American presence in these various regions. Iraq's in the middle of the Mideast. Afghanistan is in a tri-regional pivot space. Central Asia, West Asia, otherwise known as the Mideast, and South Asia. We can return to Afghanistan later if you want to talk about the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and what India is doing to help the United States with that. But the long story short is using these identity conflicts that the region is already predisposed to, the United States sought to keep Russia, China, and Iran separated through this controlled chaos, if you will. But as we see, though, when you open the Pandora's box, it doesn't always go the way that you want. When the U.S. engineered the Euromaidan urban terrorist coup in Ukraine, also rural terrorism involved as well in the western reaches, taking over military facilities, police stations, so on and so forth, was barely reported except for once or twice in Newsweek magazine. But, and forget that, who would have thought that Crimea would have reunified with Russia? Who would have thought that the chaos the U.S. unleashed in Syria would result in Russian anti-terrorist operations?
Okay, I want to just sort of move back just a little bit to some of what you're saying. We're talking a little bit about some of the antecedents of this hybrid warfare technique.
Yes.
And of course, you mentioned the name Brzezinski. And when you're talking about this idea of making use of things like ethnicity and religion and deliberately generating chaos, it's interesting to reflect on this idea of how that vision may be evolving and how much these human dynamics, psychological dynamics, are coming into play as these strategists are putting forth their operations, their military campaigns with a huge emphasis on the psychological development dimension.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to look at the personal psychological development and, if you want to focus on Brzezinski, I mean, we can't get away from the fact that he is from Poland. Why this is important is it means that he was, sometime throughout his life, he was exposed to the ideas of Piłsudski. Piłsudski was an interwar Polish leader. Some people herald him as the father of Poland after World War One. Many Polish patriots, they adore him. But why I'm bringing him up is because he had this innovative strategy called Prometheism. And this idea was really the main antecedent of the Eurasian Balkans and everything else, because if we accept that Brzezinski is the main innovator of this creative chaos Eurasian Balkans theorem, and we trace his heritage to around this time with Piłsudski, obviously Brzezinski is very well aware of international relations, literature, thought. He's a very proud Pole. I mean, he knows about Piłsudski. Piłsudski's idea was this, Michael. His idea was you have the Soviet Union. It is a very identity-diverse state, many religions, ethnicities, histories, all these hybrid war vulnerabilities that you read out in the introduction are present in the Soviet Union. So what Piłsudski's Poland wanted to do was exploit these by making these types of unholy alliances, for example, with Ukrainians, Georgians, trying to send out feelers to Chechens, things like this, to see how far they can go in undermining the identity unity or the patriotism of the Soviet Union. Now, they didn't succeed. Actually, everything had failed, and the idea is seen as actually being a failure by most. However, I take a radically different interpretation. I say that it was very far ahead of its time in the sense of looking at the Soviet Union's vulnerabilities that could in turn be transplanted to any other strategic identity-diverse state, as Brzezinski did. If we trace Brzezinski's published literature back, we see that in the late 1970s, I think it was 1978 or so, he came up with a construction called the Arc of Chaos. This is very important in the modern day because he basically says the entire Indian Ocean arc, because of he focuses on the Islamic factor, but it could be many other factors as well, but we can concentrate on the Islamic factor. Because of that, it's very vulnerable to destabilization, particularly an outside state. In this case, he suspected would be the Soviet Union. I think in this case, he was kind of mirroring what the U.S. would do in the future. He said the Soviet Union could exploit this factor to incite communist rebellions and so on and so forth. What actually had happened, though, is we see that he was already looking at weaponizing the religious factor. I mean, he was focusing on weaponizing Islam. He did this in 1979 when he openly admitted to funding and creating the Taliban with Jimmy Carter, who ironically, for some reason or another, is identified with peace, which is such a lie for many reasons, including this one, in order to incite the Soviet anti-terrorist intervention in Afghanistan. So we kind of see how this is all coming together. Now, the real antecedent, now that we're talking, I just remembered something else. We can really go back to Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. But he was trying to emphasize self-determination and democracy for all these disparate identity separate groups. U.S. did not have the capability at the time to follow through on this, but it created a very dangerous precedent of the U.S. theoretically being that global cop trying to be involved in inciting worldwide revolution. Everyone makes a big deal about Lenin and communist revolution. Nobody really focuses on the danger of what Woodrow Wilson wanted to do. Communist revolution is not happening anymore. It's not being disseminated like it was during the Soviet period with the Cold War, but which the U.S. created with Woodrow Wilson and enunciated during that time at the end of World War One, we still feel the effects today, and people are still getting killed every day over this ideology.
You know, now, Syria, the strategic importance there from the standpoint of U.S. war planners, is it strictly a pipeline, or what would you say is the main thrust of the U.S. motivation for trying to overthrow the Syrian regime?
Yeah, what it was with Syria and why the U.S. wanted to overthrow a democratically elected, legitimate Syrian government is because, yes, Syria was working on something called the Friendship Pipeline, which was envisioned to be a gas pipeline from Iran, Iraq to Syria, which would have led to Europe. And actually, in going forward with this prospective Friendship Pipeline, President Assad had rejected a Qatar pipeline through Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and or part of Iraq. It's unclear where it would have gone through Syria, then through Turkey. Now, we also can't discount when we look at the strategic situation in the Middle East, that Syria has never signed a peace treaty with this polity of Israel, people call Israel, and this actually goes back to what Hillary Clinton was actually proven to have said. I think it was in a WikiLeaks document, or I forget through which type of medium this information came out on, but that she actually said that actually this war on Syria is to protect this entity of Israel's interests. So now that relates to many things, including the Syrian government's support of Palestinian liberation movements in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, but also now we see this energy geostrategic security. But now if we also look at it in a broader context and we take away the situational triggers, which undeniably played a very large role, we see that now that we're in a new silk reality, if we will, what China's trying to do with fostering global interconnectivity, primarily through mobility, then it's going to be built up to other forms of connectivity. We see that, you know, Syria, right before the verge of these Arab Spring color revolutions, Syria had promulgated a policy called the 5C strategy. This idea was that Syria wanted to become the nexus for trade connecting the Black Sea, Caspian Sea, Persian Gulf, Red Sea, and the Mediterranean. Now, we didn't really see much from the strategy because it was promulgated right around the time when this whole thing started. But we see now with China's renewed interest in Syria, now that it seems to be almost undeniable to all that the war on the country, you know, it's favoring the government, it's favoring the people, the terrorists are definitely on the run. The war, God willing, will be resolved. Who knows when, but I feel maybe in about 6 or 8 months, fighting should be over, I hope at least. But the reason I'm bringing this up, Michael, is because Syria is located uniquely in a position where it can bring together all these routes, just like it did through the traditional Silk Road. And so we see that. Then we also have energy interest in the Mediterranean as well, and that also plays a factor. And I think that, you know, when we look at Syria's pre-existing demography, we see that the Syrian people have a very strong patriotism. These divisions that we see in society now, they're artificially created, and they're the result of traumatic, incessant warfare on the psychology of the people and also physically on their lives. The way the U.S. saw it, though, the paper reality, not the real reality, but the paper reality was, okay, there's Druze, there's Sunni, there's Shia, there's Alawite, there's Kurds. The way they saw it on paper was, hey, we can trigger a conflict, and these identities are just going to just fall apart. That wasn't actually what happened. I mean, we see some signs of it happening, particularly with the Kurds, but they were just being advantageous because they want to create what I've referred to as a second geopolitical Israel. Or in other words, a country formed out of the territory of other countries and other people with Western help in order to wage war against all the neighbors and keep the situation in a climate of instability. I mean, this is the whole point of this so-called Kurdistan. But to not digress too much, that's why Syria was targeted for the energy considerations, because the security of this entity of Israel, what people call Israel, and also because the Pentagon planners, they looked at the paper reality. They thought, hey, they can snap their fingers and it'll be over with. It wasn't. The color revolution failed. They didn't expect that. When it did fail, they tried to do their backup, which was Salafist terrorism. That failed. So then they started trying to promote this identity separateness. That mostly failed. I mean, it succeeded with some Kurdish groups, not all Kurds, though. Most Kurds are very patriotic, but sometimes, how do I say, sometimes a couple rotten apples, they might not spoil the whole bunch, but they make the whole bunch taste sour.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. This insurgency, if you will, it seemed to begin with a legitimate grievances from within the country, but you had these larger international forces, well, U.S. And their allies just infiltrating these peaceful movements with these militarized extremists, and they essentially took it over. And I think you can find something of an analog within Ukraine, where the Maidan, there were legitimate concerns with the existing government, but you had the presence of those extremist neo-Nazis and whatnot that were getting all the support through these organizations, National Endowment for Democracy and all those other entities. There are existing grievances that just kind of get inflamed with this bolstering, this sort of shot in the arm of militarized forces on one side.
Yeah, you certainly have that, but one of the things that I wrote about in my writing is about the law of hybrid war. I think it's the second edition where I compare Ukraine and Syria. Is I do mention, though, that, yes, in Syria, I mean, there is this myth that there were these pre-existing grievances, and in theory, anyone can have a grievance about anything at any time. However, factually, Syrian Arab Republic is actually, it was one of the most developed, stable, and the most secular countries in the entire Arab world. And why that's important is because this myth of grievances. I mean, yes, I read a lot of the literature about that, what people say, and I spoke to many Syrians, including quite a few Syrians that live here in Moscow that I study with. And what I've discovered is, you know, how do I say it? Some people can sometimes have their perceptions manipulated, and there is a kind of, you can say, a general psychosis going through a region, like this whole Arab Spring, this idea, this the concept of change, everybody get together, kind of played off the whole pan-Arabism of old, kind of just playing on these ideas, but doing it in a very postmodern way. It makes people, how do I say it, even people in this situation might think twice and wonder. Now, what I'm saying by this is this was meant to be large-scale psychological warfare on the minds of every Syrian, but not every Syrian bit. Yes, there were Syrians that did bite that bait. They started going out, protesting, banging drums, what have you. But we need to remember that what happened in Daraa with these supposedly the legend that these kids were spray painting some anti-government graffiti and were arrested, beat up, or whatever they say. Actually, we need to look at the real genesis that was later revealed, that actually around that time, terrorists were killing police officers and killing military servicemen. Government was keeping it under wraps for a bit because they didn't want to contribute to this psychosis, this outbreak of psychosis that was sweeping the region that we now call in hindsight the so-called Arab Spring. But that's what was happening, actually. I mean, there were some pretty bad people that were starting to kill police officers, killing troops, I mean, starting to attack regular people in crowds. And
sounds
then you
similar
have the whole information warfare level within.
Yeah, it sounds similar to when there was the lead up to the NATO's aggression in Yugoslavia, where you're sort of reporting on the discontent with the Yugoslav government. But like, it's only one side that seems to be getting the sympathy of the wider international public, and so you have a lot of provocation of the government that's
yes,
not
being absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because with the whole provocation is that that fulfills what I've called a trigger event. Is typically in order to catalyze the masses, those that are already earlier socially preconditioned to accepting some type of regime change movement, whether they call it a democracy movement, a Salafist movement, what have you, any type of identity separateness, there typically is a trigger, even in the case of Ukraine, signing or not signing a controversial piece of legislation, the EU association agreement. Now, in Syria, you didn't have that. Actually, the provocations, the trigger events had to be entirely manufactured. Hence the information warfare and blowing out of proportion this idea of those Daraa children and all this other stuff. And actually, that these self-perpetuating or auto-synchronous processes work is they kind of feed off of provocations to where they try to create one. So once one is created, the information warfare component blows it out of proportion, gives it that role of being a trigger event, throw the emotions onto it, the way they market it, the way they present it, as a way to increase the information warfare on the targeted population, turn it up a couple notches, and get regular people so incensed because they're misled, they go out, take part in the protest, maybe get beat up themselves by some of these provocateurs, but they don't realize it until afterwards. I mean, this is the whole thing. The provocations in Syria were entirely manufactured through the hybrid warfare waged against it, but in Ukraine, for as manufactured the situation was, it was working along. They were taking advantage of actual situations that were already occurring. They were already polarizing, for better or for worse. And all countries do polarizing things. You make a decision, right or wrong, yes or no, A or B. It's natural. But they chose to make this a false civilizational choice in Ukraine, hence why that EU association agreement became the trigger event. Whereas in Syria, no one could really put a finger on any trigger event because there wasn't any. There were a bunch of provocations that attempted to be a trigger event, the most famous one of which was this chemical weapons false flag hoax carried out by Turkish-supported, American-supported, Qatari, Israeli, and Saudi-supported so-called rebels, actually terrorists. But that's what happened. I mean, this is a big difference here. But what we can learn from this, though, Michael, is actually provocations, they can be planned far in advance. And you see in media that typically doesn't know anything about a country reporting on it like they're experts. Those people have been given a script. Those people have been given talking points, and they're trying to mislead the audience, like what's happening in Ethiopia, for example, or what's always happening with Pakistan, for example. These are perfect, perfect instances.
Mm-hmm. When we're talking about media and also the existence of social media and the internet, what kind of an interaction are we seeing there? Because we kept hearing so much with regard to the so-called Arab Spring about how the Twitter and social media was getting all this information out there. That's had some kind of an accelerator effect for this whole concept of hybrid war, is it not?
Yeah, it did, absolutely. And that's what I talk about in my book, which is available on orientalreview.org. I believe you guys also had a link on Global Research a while back, too, which thank you for that as well. I was very honored that you guys had posted on the site. And I write about how social media, particularly Twitter, is used as a tactical organizational mechanism. Basically, what I mean, and to simplify it, it's used to organize people, disseminate information, and get them to attack, be it swarm, which could be violent or nonviolent, or physically attack in a rough location at a split second. Basically, because it can be organized so quickly and the information disseminated to a broad group of people at the snap of a finger, it's very difficult for the government to respond to that as it's happening. Now, governments could take proactive measures in terms of street barriers, curfews, the many different things they can do, but Twitter is meant to give the insurgents, the urban insurgents, split-second change of plans and split-second flexibility with what they want to do. Facebook is very important because that's used to disseminate information. I get a lot of good information from Facebook, but Facebook can be abused. All these technologies can be abused. It can be used for good or bad. It's like a gun. It can be for a freedom fighter or for a terrorist. Depends on who's holding it and for what purposes. I mean, you have Google Maps, excellent resource. But on the other hand, if you're just sitting around with a couple of people and you're getting paid by an NGO to protest and create protest routes and where you're going to have supplies and all kinds of other devious things, if you want to take it that far, Google Maps is the best thing to ever happen to any tech, to be honest with you. But it's also one of the best things to happen to anybody. So it's all in the eye of the beholder, how you use it. We see YouTube, for example. YouTube is fantastic for propaganda dissemination. So many times I have seen so many fake or misleading videos from Syria, Ukraine, what have you. What they're doing is they show a situation decontextualized. Sometimes it's even fake.
Exactly.
We know now,
yeah.
Pentagon spent $500 million in terrorist propaganda, and it was fake. Makes you wonder how much of this is false flag propaganda. I mean, you know that. That's what's happening.
The point is,
on YouTube,
yeah.
And they make a news article.
Yeah, the point is that, you're living in this media atmosphere now where everybody's trying to one-up each other and trying to get the scoop and trying to get the latest information, but it's so hard to get proper sourcing on any of that. And how many people can even afford to take the time to do those fact checks when you've got that accelerator effect that it's – I mean, you're not just competing for the 5 o'clock news. I mean, you got to – when the story is changing and you're in a dynamic which is changing minute to minute, this becomes urgent to get this stuff out. So even if you just have a hunch, probably right, and so you just put it out there before you have a chance to really investigate, and that's a huge, it's very helpful to those forces that are looking to instigate their own malevolent ends.
Yeah, it certainly is, and actually, that's what we come to when we talk about structural preconditioning. Is right now in the average mindset, I'd say most of the people that are in the mindset is that, hey, just like you described, it's split second news. You have to make a decision. Are you going to promote it? Are you going to share it? Even if the news outlet decides not to, you have thousands of people on social media that can. Many people now, in some countries, the majority of people that are youth, they're getting the information on their phone from Facebook. That's where they're getting the news. So what you really need is people need to have their own interpretive framework for deciphering events. They need to have their own standards. Sometimes they need to go with their guts. But people need to literally question what's happening, and then you sometimes step back and think, what I do, Michael, when I read something about a rapidly developing situation, one of the first things that I do is if I'm reading it and I feel a certain emotion that feels like it wants to compel me to do something in the back of my mind, I stop and I think, because that emotion was implanted in my brain through those words, those images, those sounds, and that's not something natural that I would be feeling. I know that is a direct result. It is a direct result of this information warfare. So if people are reading something, and if something, this isn't all the time, and this is in general, with controversial situations, if someone feels like provoked to act, right? If they feel like this is trying to provoke the reader to act and do something that's against my values, against my morals, against my principles, well, more than likely it is. And more than likely, you're actually one of the 1% that's stopping and thinking about it and not going out in the street holding a sign one day, holding a gun the next. Next thing you know, you got bodies at your feet and a hot gun in your waist. That's how these things actually work with some of the people. And they're getting paid for, they're getting incited, or they're taking advantage of crowd mentality. All these things, this is the way these things work. And some of these NGO people, yes, there are innocent NGOs. There are NGOs that work with environmental, humanitarian concerns. There are some legitimate ones. But in general now, with what we've seen happen with these so-called white helmets, which are just Al-Qaeda with the helmet, when we see Soros Foundation, which is basically CIA in CIA in jeans, if you will, trying to fit in whatever country they're located in, it just makes people distrust what's happening. And that's how we have to face these things. We need to distrust it. If it's foreign finance and if it's operating in your country and if it has anything to do with politics, it needs to be labeled a foreign agent or needs to be kicked out.
So taking everything that we've been discussing and, with regard to the Syria and Ukraine cases, let's, as you say, take it to a practical application and learn where we can predict the next important hybrid wars are about to strike. So where would you like to looking at some of those other areas, like what's an important flashpoint that we should be keeping our eye on right now?
Oh, there's actually two, and they're erupting simultaneously. Basically, before I say what they are, I want to remind everybody that these hybrid wars are meant to target transnational connective infrastructure projects to either disrupt, control, or influence them using identity conflict in the targeted state, supported by lead-from-behind actors, a.k.a. American proxy allies. Well, one of the most important that's happening right now, you have the China Package and Economic Corridor. It is the most, it's the largest Silk Road project, at least $46 billion committed so far. So it's a staple of the whole Silk Road all across the world, being built at an astronomical pace. The whole point is to connect China to the Indian Sea to get around the Strait of Malacca. Very strategic. Why are they doing that? They couldn't go through Myanmar, because the government there kind of took a couple of steps back from China, and they stopped a high-speed rail project that was supposed to go from Kunming, which is the capital of Yunnan province, to Kwakfu, which is a bordering port in Rakhine State. That's also erupting now, interestingly, because Su Ji has now gone back into possible negotiations with the Chinese for this possible railroad. Her last time in Beijing, now you just had, I think you had like 9 police officers killed yesterday in Rakhine State. We can discuss that in a second. But getting back to Pakistan, this project, CPEC, as it's colloquially called, It's huge. It is literally, it is like the, it's the jugular vein of the multipolar world. It's one of the jugular veins, other than the one going between Russia and China and Kazakhstan. Now, the problem, though, is India. India, great country, wonderful civilization, amazing people, very friendly. I mean, great culture. But the problem is, country has turned towards the United States. Within the course of 2.5 years, Narendra Modi, who follows the Hindutva ideology, it is a Hindu supremacist ideology. Anyone can look it up, a very, very violent type of ideology. I compare it to Wahhabism, American exceptionalism, and Zionism. To be honest with you, this is how bad it is. Anyhow, he sided with the United States against China. It wasn't hard to do. I mean, he's a Hindu nationalist. He hates China for his own reasons. There have already been pre-existing border disputes between China and India. So it was an easy catch for the United States. You get this guy in power, he's basically going to do whatever. Even though he was previously on a travel ban by the U.S. and EU, they co-opted him like that in the snap of a finger. Now what's happened is India is working with Afghanistan to destabilize Pakistan. India's research and analysis wing, known as RAW, it's their version, the CIA, has been supporting certain terrorists going across the a Pakistani border. At the same time, India, unprecedentedly, Modi, on the Indian Independence Day speech, 69th anniversary of independence, it was this August, he spoke about Balochistan. This is a transnational region, sub-state region, between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. The Baloch people, they don't number that much, but they're very strategically located. Why? The terminal point for CPEC ends in Pakistani Balochistan, the port of Gwadar. Well, he wants that area to be independent. He's been very, very insistent about this. It's very obvious what he wants. He wants to give political asylum and even possibly make this one Baloch independence leader guy who's living in Europe now, even make him the head of a government in exile. Basically, he wants to pull a Tibet with what, you know, India was doing with Tibet against China for decades with the United States. That's very dangerous. It's also dangerous because India has investments across the border in Iran and Chabahar port with the North-South corridor, which will connect India, Iran, Azerbaijan, Russia, and all the way to West Europe. Any type of transnational separatist conflict in Pakistani Balochistan is going to go into Iranian Balochistan. And Iran sees that. That's why Iran has recently decided to work with CPEC and possibly even invite China and Pakistan to cooperate in the Indian finance port. And of course, we have Kashmir, which is Indian held, but for the world's largest so-called democracy, they don't want to have an independence referendum, which is very ironic. Second project, Michael, is what's happening in East Africa. China built a railroad between Djibouti to Addis Ababa, capital of Ethiopia. Djibouti is an interesting country. It has U.S., Saudi, French, even Japanese forces sitting there. China's opening its first overseas base there. Why Ethiopia is important, it has 100 million people, very identity diverse, one of the fastest growing economies in the world, still comparatively poor though, has amazing industrialization potential. It's China's number one African ally. China needs an overseas market for its overcapacity, for its overproduction in mainland China. Why? China doesn't want to slow down their factories, you increase unemployment, you increase unrest. Next thing you know, you make yourself even more vulnerable to color revolution. It's unnecessary. Might as well keep selling, basically. China also wants to lift Africans out of poverty. China sees the Chinese dream in Africa. What Africa is going through, China went through in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and is still going through to an extent. So it wants to work with Ethiopia. Same time, though, over the past 10, 11 months, there have been some protests among some of the larger pluralities of the country, the Amhara and the Oromia. The Oromia are the largest in Ethiopia. What's interesting, Michael, is we talk about the media, and you mentioned that earlier, and I think I remarked on a pre-planned provocation. But you had an Ethiopian runner in the Rio Olympics, forget his name, don't even know what track event he was running in. All I know is he got a silver medal. How do I know it? It was all over CNN. Why? Across the finish line, he had his arms up as an X. Apparently, this is some sign of protest. The media went wild. Why? It was pre-planned. It was pre-planned to have this guy do a protest at the Rio Olympics to create this information warfare, to draw attention to what's happening in Ethiopia. Now these Ethiopian rioters are burning down international factories, international flour companies. You know, the Dutch flour companies are being burnt down, Turkish factories destroyed. Why? They want to step up international pressure in Ethiopia. They want to divide Ethiopia and get rid of China's plan. You get rid of the Djibouti Addis Ababa Railroad, get rid of Ethiopia, which has many problems, don't get me wrong.
It's not a saintly state by any means, but it's trying. It's made a lot of progress in the past 2 decades. Then, you know, it's going to be a lot more difficult for Africans to rise up out of unipolarity and enter the multipolar world. So these two things, Ethiopia and Pakistan, that's where it's at right now, against CPEC, using India, and against Djibouti, Addis Ababa Railroad, using Gulf Cooperation Coalition, and Council, sorry, and also using Egypt and Eritrea.
We're seeing huge refugee flows, you know, springing out of, these areas in North Africa and, Syria and nearby areas. I'm wondering where these huge refugee flows figure into the hybrid war scenario.
Oh, this is very, I've written about this multiple times on Katehan, which everyone can check out. Main principle is this. Western European countries were leaning towards Russia right before the start of this immigrant crisis. However, the United States feels uncomfortable about that for many reasons. It's very obvious. I mean, if Europe started economically cooperating more with Russia and China, U.S. would lose its unipolar influence to an extent. The best way to prevent that from happening is to insert hybrid war variables into the targeted countries. Now, it's a lot harder, to do than it might sound. I mean, how do you get Germans to want to overthrow a German government? I mean, it would have seemed kind of crazy a couple years ago, right? Look at the German disposition. They're not those type of people. Well, you see what's happening. I mean, Europe's strongest economy. People don't usually protest. Now you have over a million, civilization dissimilar, quote-unquote refugees. And I emphasize the civilizational dissimilarity, not because there's anything wrong with that. Not at all. I mean, actually, I embrace all people. I have no problem with where someone's from, what their creed is, nor what language they speak. But I'm saying this to emphasize how the average person looks at it, how the average host, population, individual looks at it. They see a bunch of people coming in that don't speak the language, don't want to work, a lot of them being very aggressive towards women especially. And they say, hey, now they're getting upset. Now you start seeing now, a couple years ago, there was no domestic tension in Germany. Now it's all over. It's in Germany, France, Austria. It's in all these countries that could have been pragmatic partners with the multipolar world to different extents. Now, it gets as simple as if any of these leaders, if they ever wanted to, let's just say, partner with Russia or partner with China, sign a free trade deal with China, for example, you can best believe, be it between the hardcore Salafists, be it between the neo-Nazis, the militant leftists, I mean, this is also a problem. Not many people have focused on there. Unfortunately, a lot of people with leftist ideology have been very, very militant throughout this immigrant crisis. You have these people rising up. You have regular citizens rising up because they're scared. They're calling the middle, regular, real refugees, real immigrants calling the middle. You have social chaos. You have the exact preconditions needed to create a situation where a government could be compelled to step down, early elections held, new U.S. public gets in. How do you create these large flows of people? Well, you destroy those countries. I mean, there wouldn't be people leaving if it wasn't for the war on Syria, the war on Libya, and the war on Yemen. We can't forget that. And we see, though, some of these people leaving, though, they're not all good guys. I mean, if we look or girls, but most of them are actually guys. We look at Syria, for example, most of the, displaced people are currently displaced. They're in, areas protected by their government, the Syrian Arab Army. They don't want to leave. I'm not saying if you leave, you're a terrorist or anything like that. But, I mean, some of the people that did leave, evidently, I mean, they obviously have Salafist dispositions. We see them. We see them cut off a hand in Syria. Next day, they're hugging a kid in, Germany or Switzerland or something like that.
And
then you have copycat refugees.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Only got about a minute left. But I was wondering if there's maybe some way we could kind of just try to bring the conversation to a close, maybe with some sort of maybe certain tips, hints for whether it's countries like Russia and China or, just independent countries, like the best defense against this kind of hybrid warfare manipulation. Are there any hints at how these, what the Achilles heels of these the hybrid war planners might be?
Okay, the way I see it, these countries are always playing defense. So the game's kind of skewed in one direction from the get-go. But that being said, they need to emphasize patriotism, which is very different than nationalism. President Putin quoted a Russian philosopher sometime over the summer or around May, and he said, he's very clear about it, patriotism is love of your country, nationalism is hatred of the other. It's very important because in identity-diverse states like the Russian Federation, Syrian Arab Republic, People's Republic of China, Islamic Republic of Iran, there are many different identities, people, creed, ethnicities. And people need to sit together. They need to have a unified idea, a unified reason, an integrated historical idea to want to stick together and to want to repel any of these information provocations. The more patriotic a population is, the less susceptible it is to hybrid warfare, to hybrid warfare's organic infiltration, quote unquote. By that, I mean using the information, the NGOs, and so on and so forth. Next, they need to, like I mentioned earlier, if there's any type of foreign-funded non-government organization in your country, it needs to be not labeled. It needs to be branded as a foreign agent or kicked out of the country, and some need to be kicked out. Soros Foundation is illegal in the Russian Federation, and I say thank God, Michael. Next, you also have to make sure, I mean, your borders are secure. You have to also have rapid reaction task forces because mercenaries will pull through. I mean, they're going to go across the border. You have to be able to watch out for that. And next, you need to have a very strong narrative to counter this information right away. This is where alternative media comes in and patriotic NGOs inside the targeted state. The more patriotic people are, the more people are reminded of the counter-narrative, in this case, the truth to the propaganda, the less likely they are to believe it. Then the provocateurs are going to expose themselves by being few in number. They're going to have less human shields surrounding them. By human shields, I mean interested folks to get caught up in this protest. They think it's revolution. They think it's fun and games. They go around for the ride. Someone gets shot in the head by a sniper, this type of stuff, okay? Less likely that's going to happen. So you're able to isolate the problem. You're able to target it. You target it physically. You target on the information front. Then you push back. You push back by exposing it. You expose what's happening. You expose the networks. And you expose the future scenarios. When people are positively preconditioned into what can happen if they go along with the stuff, they're going to be less likely to do it because they see what's going to happen. And the best way to precondition someone is with facts. Show them what happened to Syrian Arab Republic with the hybrid war in that country. Show them what happened to Libya, Iraq. Show them what's happening in the Balkans. Show them that stuff. Make them aware and remind them because some people, they don't have long memories. They need to be reminded. All you got to do is turn on a TV and you're reminded.
Intellectual inoculation. I could go down with that. I want to thank you very much, Andrew Korobko. I'm sorry we've got to call it quits for now, but I really enjoyed this conversation, however troubling some of the subject matter could be. But thanks again for joining us on this Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you to the audience for tuning in.
Andrew Korobko is an American political commentator based in Moscow and currently reporting for Sputnik News Agency. He's the author of the 2015 book Hybrid Wars, The Indirect Adaptive Approach to Regime Change, and his work frequently appears on the Global Research website, among other online journals. Just one final note before we close the show. The Honorable Paul Hellyer, book author, activist, and cabinet minister under three Liberal prime ministers, will be speaking in cities in Western Canada over the next few weeks. He's promoting a new social contract with the people that calls for the use of the Bank of Canada to finance critical and needed national initiatives. On October 20th, Mr. Hellyer will speak in Winnipeg at the University of Winnipeg in Eckhart Gramaté Hall on the third floor of Centennial Hall at 7 p.m. Then in Calgary, on Monday, October 24th at 6 p.m., he speaks at the John Dutton Theatre Library at 616 McLeod Trail Southeast. Mr. Hellyer speaks in Edmonton on Wednesday, October 26th at 7 p.m. at Central Lions Recreation at 11113 113th Street. He speaks in Victoria on Friday, October 28th at Camosun College Lansdowne Campus, Fisher 100 at 3100 Fowl Bay Road. Finally, Mr. Hellyer speaks in Vancouver on Tuesday, November 1st on the UBC campus in room Buchanan A201 at 1866 Main Mall. For more details about the tour, visit www.canadianbankreformers.ca/tour.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.